CNN's John King kicks things off on today's BPR with a profound apology from a president and a non-apology from a would-be president. Then Globe business columnist Shirley Leung joins us to debate the two hottest topics in and around Boston, fixing the tee and deciding on an Olympics bid. Then it's Ask the Mayor. Marty Walsh makes his monthly appearance, taking your calls on everything from those two issues to will First Night survive, to diversity in the city workforce, to kindness.
Emily Rooney updates us on the Tsarnaev trial and entertains us with her ever-brilliant list of observation and complaints. We'll ask you, the MBTA was free today, though you may not have noticed, even if you wrote it. Then our news quiz, we're going to be joined by the creators of the Barmobile. What's that? Stay tuned. You're just going to love it. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hey, Jim.
Okay, you criticized me yesterday off air saying I was not upbeat enough when you said good morning, and all I said was good morning. So, hey, Marjorie. How you doing?
No, it wasn't that.
Hey there.
You were like a Yogi Bear thing. Hello, Marjorie.
Okay, hi, Marjorie. It's good to see you.
Hi, Jim.
So Russia's president, by way of a Canadian company, gets closer to realizing his dreams of controlling the world's uranium supply chain. But how he got there involves a former U.S. president and his wife who aspires to be the next one. Sounds like the House of Cards, more like the House of Clinton. Could new revelations about foreign donors to the Clinton Foundation hurt Hillary Clinton's campaign? Joining us to talk about this and much more is CNN's chief national correspondent. That, of course, would be John King. Good morning, John.
I have to be very upbeat, right? Can't be Yogi Bear. I don't want to sound like Eeyore. You know, nobody cares.
Exactly. I forget who Yogi's sidekick was, but that's what he reminded me.
Boo-boo.
Oh, Boo-Boo. Hey, Boo-Boo. That's me. I'm Boo-Boo here.
This is horrible. Hi, John.
Hello. Happy Tuesday. I think this is a big story, and the reason I think so is not just because of the facts involved, but because of how aggressively the Clinton campaign is pushing back, saying, you know, it's a partisan story written by a partisan hack being promoted by partisan people. That's textbook Clinton playbook. The author of this book, Clinton Cash, is a conservative. He comes from a conservative think tank that has received a lot of money from conservatives like the Koch brothers. So it's T-ball and easy for the Democrats. At the same time, the New York Times did its own independent reporting on this. And it looks horrible. Let's assume for a minute the Clintons did nothing wrong. There was nothing nefarious here. The State Department signed off on this. She had nothing to do with it. It just went through. It just looks horrible. The Clinton Foundation is getting money from the Canadian businessmen involved in this deal. Then he goes to Moscow and gets paid a huge speaking fee by a bank that's involved in this deal. And she wants to be president of the United States. It just looks horrible. But their answer is, you know, we did nothing wrong, go away. But I suspect these questions are going to continue.
You know, to me, the only good news this week for Hillary Clinton is that Republicans want not one but two hearings, you know, one about the emails and one about Benghazi, because that could look like a partisan piling on. But when you read the story about Russia, then you combine that with this amended their tax returns because they inaccurately
reported.
The Clinton Foundation. Yes, because they inaccurately reported the IRS that they'd accepted no government money. You know, to me, this is the biggest danger she faces, is that this steady drip, 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 drip of scandals. Scandal may be too strong a word, but odd goings on, let's put it that way, that makes people weary of going back into all that, that we're going to take our eye off the ball of the big problems to be constantly having hearings about the Clintons and what they're doing. You know what I mean?
I agree completely. If there were no new revelations here and the Republicans were just saying, you know, Johnny Chung, White House coffees, Lincoln bedroom, Monica Lewinsky, I think a lot of voters would rightly say, you know, that's more about him than about her, and that was all 15, 20 years ago. You know, what about her economic plan? What about her record as Secretary of State? I do think, and look, I think that we live in a polarized America, and that's why Democrats are saying this is, you know, nothing, and it's just all Republican smear, and Republicans say it's more proof that the Clintons. Mitt Romney used the word bribery yesterday on the Hugh Hewitt show. He said it smells like bribery to him. That might be a little strong, but I think your other point, Marjorie, is right on, because we've watched this play out in the past, and one of the reasons Team Clinton is using the old Bill Clinton playbook, just attack the source of the information as partisan and as unreliable is because that's what worked in the old days. That's what worked against Ken Starr, and that's what worked against Newt Gingrich. And, you know, I tell this, and I say it's a joke. I'm not sure it is a joke. But, you know, Bill Clinton was impeached for his behavior in the Monica Lewinsky scandal. However, he kept his job. Two Republican speakers lost theirs, Newt Gingrich and Bob Livingston, because the Republican Party overstepped.
Yeah.
The Republican Party did overreach and overstepped. And so there is a risk for Republicans. There are legitimate questions here. I get hammered by Democrats when I say, I'm sorry, I don't think that she had the singular authority to decide on her own, you know, what is government property and what's not when it comes to her emails, and then to wipe the server without any independent verification that she was making the right call. Again, assume for the sake of this conversation she has done absolutely nothing wrong. Then why not have a second voice, just an independent just person come in and just look at it and double check for you so that you have a backup? That's the part. If there are questions about foreign contributions to the foundations, questions about her role in that, questions about the email servers, I do think for some voters who want, you know, they want change, they want somebody new, they want a fresh environment, and they want a Washington that might at least try to work better, I do think it's potentially damaging.
Well, I also think that the hatred in some quarters for Barack Obama can be easily transferred for different reasons to a hatred of Hillary Clinton if she wins the White House. But the other thing I was going to ask you, and maybe I've just forgotten, John, which is certainly probably the case, but when I think of the controversies that surrounded Barack Obama or surrounded George Bush II, I think for the most part they were about, you know, whether you thought Obamacare was a good idea or a terrible idea, whether he was doing the right thing, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan or the wrong thing. You know, a weak president or strong, and Bush, of course, about the war and stuff. I don't remember any of these extracurricular things, you know, maybe except, you know, was Michelle Obama doing the right thing by school lunches or something? I mean, I'm trying to compare something in their administration.
Well, Reverend Wright, but it wasn't as an administration issue, it was during the campaign.
It was also a campaign issue. Was there like a Whitewater type thing or this kind of thing with those presidencies? I don't remember them.
I think, and again, there are people out there who will find an example, and either a Democrat or Republican will say I'm nuts, but I do think that to the credit of both President George W. Bush, who was undermined largely by, you know, incompetence running the Iraq War,
right,
a big debate about whether it was the right decision to go there in the first place, then Katrina and what I'll call the competence question, there were no, you know, they caught nobody with their hand in the cookie jar in a major way.
Yeah.
And the same with the Obama administration. There has not been any Watergate-like government corruption. Now, there are Republicans listening right now who say, what about the IRS scandal and cracking down on the Tea Party groups? We don't have the final verdict on some of these things. There may well be some people who made political mistakes there. We haven't seen a financial scandal of any huge magnitude. I'm sure somebody can find an example and say, here's one. But of somebody, you know, cooking the books or stealing from the government.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, in two administrations in a row. And look, in the Bill Clinton administration, you know, again, it was just, it's the kind of stuff that it may not be illegal. It may not be unethical. It may be within the regulations. But, you know, the White House coffees and that whole thing, it just made you want to take a shower. You know, every time you read about it, it's just like, ugh. And it's unseemly. And look, this town's broken. That's not Hillary Clinton's fault. It's not, you know, it's not John Boehner's fault. It's everybody's fault. Everybody who has had a stake in Washington, it's probably my fault to a degree, too. But this town is broken. And so I do think if you're trying to make the case that I can begin to fix it, the next president is not going to be able to completely fix it. But if you want to make the case that I can begin to fix it, I do think it's, you know, this kind of stuff hurts your cause.
One last thing on this, John, if I can, is I'm assuming, and this is not an anti or pro-Hillary comment, it's just an observation. If Hillary Clinton was in the middle of a pack with seven other Democrats, I would assume that her campaign would be doomed by this. She'd be seen as too risky. She's now obviously beating everybody 3-1. They're not even any real candidate. Well, with all due respect to the Sanders and others of the world, credible candidates. Are big-time Democrats talking to people like you off the record or on background and saying, we're actually worried about what's going to happen with this? Should she be the nominee?
They still think that she is, with all the names they can put on a piece of paper today, they still think she is by far their most formidable candidate because of her legitimate and experience in government, because of her stature as a Clinton, because of her fundraising ability as a Clinton, because of the demographic advantage as a woman, because of the loyalty within the party to her. And history says, you know, you lose the White House after your party has had it for two terms. George H.W. Bush kept it after Ronald Reagan, but you have to go way back from there to find that happening again. And so history says the Democrats will lose after Barack Obama has the White House for two terms, just like the Republicans lost after Bush had it for two terms. And so that's one of the reasons we've had this rally around Hillary moment, because they just look around and they think, you know, yeah, we got nobody else who's as good as her. They still think that. I was in New York last week with a lot of people who are big donors in the Democratic Party, and they were all like, yeah, no excitement about her. And I was just out in California for a couple of days, and kind of the same thing. They all think she's their strongest candidate, but they're not like fired up like, yeehaw, let's go. Now, to your other point, Jim, quickly, that's the great advantage for Kemp Clinton right now, is that Martin O'Malley right now is not viewed as a serious challenger to Hillary Clinton, but he's a governor. You know, he was a governor of a state. He was a mayor before that. If he were to start running around talking about this stuff, then she might have a problem. Yeah. If he started to Democratic audiences saying, this is not a Republican conspiracy, yes, the Republicans might be over-exaggerating it, they might be hyping it, but there are legitimate questions here, then she might have a problem. That would put more pressure on her to have to explain it more. But unless and until you get the pressure from Democrats, then you will have Republicans, some of whom will no doubt overreach in what they say, and the media saying, you know, we're not getting good answers. That's not enough to derail Hillary Clinton from getting the nomination. What happens from that point on? Who knows?
We're talking to John King from CNN. John, the president had a schizophrenic day yesterday. We're going to play you the sound of, like, showing the stark contrast. You'll hear President Obama apologizing for U.S. drone strike that killed two al-Qaeda hostages, including, unfortunately, an American citizen, Warren Weinstein. And then we're going to hear the president, Giovanni Laporta as well. He was the Italian, but Weinstein's the American. Well, in any case, the president made a Deflategate joke when the Patriots visited the White House. Here it is.
President, and as commander-in-chief, I take full responsibility for all our counterterrorism operations, including the one that inadvertently took the lives of Warren and Giovanni. I profoundly regret what happened.
I usually tell a bunch of jokes at these events, but with the Patriots in town, I was worried that 11 out of 12 of them would fall flat.
You know, I want to get back to the thing that really matters there, John, the whole the drone attack. But what struck me, the reason we played that for you and for the listeners, I can't imagine how a human being can do the job of president of the United States. Yesterday morning, he gave what, at least as an observer, I thought was one of his most heartfelt, somber appearances, talking about the drone strike. And then just hours later, he's got to make small talk and jokes with a football team. I mean, what is it? And you've been following these guys for decades. What is it in these people that allows them to be able to pull that thing off?
There's the great politicians are the ones who can just bounce from event to event, who can internalize things, who can deal with the hard stuff, and then actually go looking for a chance to laugh, to kind of break up their day. I beat him up sometimes, and I think this, you know, the president deserves credit for what he did yesterday about the drone strikes, in that he could have easily passed that off to the Defense Department and had somebody else come out and make the announcement. And you know, he didn't have to go into the briefing room and do that, but that's what I'll call a leader thing to do, is to, you know, to say, look, I'm the commander-in-chief, the buck stops with me, and to explain, you know, to the degree they can, what happened. And he deserves credit for that, and any president does. That's not a partisan statement. I think when we have transparency in government and leaders stepping up and not only, you know, doing dances when they think they've done something right, but admitting when something goes wrong and being candid about it and sober and somber about it, as you said, I think, you know, any president deserves credit for that, and he does here. The thing, you know, you go through this. I mean, I remember this, you know, I'll go back to the Bush example. When Iraq was so unpopular and Bush was traveling around the country, I was still covering the White House in those days, and, you know, we would ask him sometimes if we got a chance, you know, Mr. President, it must be tough. You know, you're going out there and you're seeing all these signs and these protests. And he would always joke. He goes, what do you mean? I walk, look out the window, I'm a motorcade all the time, and everyone's giving me, and he'd put up his middle finger. He'd say, they all think I'm number one. and he would say it with a laugh, but he had a way, you know, the good politicians just have a way to, you know, like a duck, to let the rainwater hit them and go off. And I'm not saying the president's not, you know, processing what happened with the drone strikes. I don't mean it that way, but they do know how to sort of go from the bad to the good and to look for a chance to joke. And that's I guess it's the test of any leader, but you see it more publicly, obviously, in our politicians.
You know, one of the things that he's confronting, Marjorie and I are talking to you from, well, your hometown, which also happens to have the second largest concentration of Armenians in the United States of America. Today is the 100th anniversary of the Armenian genocide. And while a lot of criticism is heaped on the Turkish government for refusing to acknowledge that there was a genocide, the President of the United States, who pledged in 2008 when he's running for president that he would declare it a genocide, not only that, but the woman who subsequently became his ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, I remember seeing a video in which she said, you should vote for Barack Obama because he is going to declare this a genocide. He's refused to, for fear that he's going to mess up our important strategic relationship with Turkey. How much heat has he taken, or is just a narrow focus of America that's upset about this?
No, there's a lot of heat. There's obviously, you know, the Armenian community is most upset about this because they feel he has broken a promise to them, much like, you know, this is a separate issue, but the Latino community felt he broke a promise to them for a long time by not introducing legislation. I always say in these examples that running for president is a whole lot easier than being president. You know, Bill Clinton back in the day ran against the butchers in Beijing and the dictators in Damascus, and then had pretty good relations with old man Assad and had very good relations with the Chinese government. But it sounded good when he was running for president, didn't it? It is harder. But I also think, again, I just gave the president a lot of credit for his transparency and his candor coming into the briefing room yesterday. This is one of those things where, you know, yes, the Turkish government would be very upset. This Turkish government is, if you talk to people involved with it, you know, they can be a little temperamental. I still think if you're the leader of the free world, he's had 7 years now to do the internal diplomacy to say, I have to do this because it's the right thing to do, and I promised, but it also happens to be the truth. So, you know, how do I do this in a way that makes it better for you guys? Have the private conversations, you know, say something nice about Turkey when you say it. Just say, you know, since then and today, it's a very different Turkey, and then they're helping us here, here, and here. But he hasn't done it, and that's his decision. And again, you know, I don't get the briefing book every morning. I'm not in the, you know, classified briefings. I don't have those sensitive conversations with the Turks when you're trying to move military equipment around or do things that, you know, are off the books and under the radar. And so he has clearly made a calculation that he's willing to take the heat for breaking his promise. And, you know, I suspect we don't know the entire story behind his explanation.
We're talking with John King from CNN. John, I'm going to move from the serious to the Page Six gossip question. Tom Brady, our quarterback, unlike the previous appearances at the White House, at least one, I know he was when he was there with George Bush and the Patriots won the Super Bowl, Brady showed up. A no-show on this visit. Is anybody, you know, saying anything about this or speculating that Tom Brady may be a tea partier or anything like that? That's why he didn't go.
I did get asked when I came into the building this morning. I was off for a couple of days, and I came into the building early this morning, and people wanted to know what I knew about it, and I said, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Is he a Republican or is he on a beach? I don't know the answer. We should track his financial contributions, see if he's donated any campaigns out there.
You know, changing gears to a more serious thing, we may have discussed this with you a month or two ago when it was clear this was going to happen, but I have to say, I think we've been criticizing the FBI the last few days for this report that came out of the Washington Post based on Justice Department research about these hair experts who basically were cooking the books in hundreds of cases, some of which led to executions. But I have to say, I have to give him praise for standing up to the Justice Department and saying to Eric Holder, essentially, how dare you give General Petraeus probation when he jeopardized national security, subsequently lied to the FBI. You treat mid-level people who are responsible for leaks far more seriously than this. What's the word on the street? I know he's a celebrated general, brilliant strategist, the author of the Surge strategy. What's the word on the street in Washington about whether or not this guy got a special deal?
There is a lot of grumbling that there's a double standard here because of his heroism as a military commander, not just in leading the surge, but earlier in, you know, or throughout his career. He is an American hero. He's also a very flawed American hero who broke the law and did something reprehensible. Part of the argument from the government is that, you know, he shared this stuff with his girlfriend, but, you know, there wasn't a lot of damage done. There, you know, there's no, nothing was undermined, no operations were compromised, you know, and so they would make the argument that, you know, and they may have to make this argument someday if, what if, you know, Edward Snowden never comes back to American soil. And they say, you know, are they going to say they want the death penalty? I mean, part of the alleged conversations about trying to get him to come back is to say they would take the death penalty off the table if he would come back and stand trial. And I think Edward Snowden on the scale, there are Edward Snowden defenders out there who say it's, you know, was worth doing in the cause of good government. But on the scale of the classified release, it's obviously a lot more information than General Petraeus is accused of sharing. But there is a sense that, you know, and remember, a lot of Republicans love General Petraeus. So if you had a Democratic administration do this and he was not held in high regard by Republicans, you might have more of a political furor. You don't hear it from the political, you know, leading political figures very much. But you do hear it on the street that, you know, wow, you know, that's a celebrity double standard.
Oh, my goodness. The older I get, the more I think there's a celebrity double standard. There's a rich poor double standard. There's a black white double standard. Our justice system, I don't think, is acquitting itself particularly well, or hasn't in quite some time. But anyway, that's an editorial comment on the side.
Yeah, John, before you go, I am jealous of you in many ways, I should say. One of the many ways is you get to go to the White House Press Correspondents' Dinner. I don't. And one of my favorite moments, and we've played this about 10,000 times on the show, I think this is Barack Obama's first White House Press Correspondents' Dinner, and he's talking about the Speaker of the House, who I think most people know, John Boehner, has a rather interesting hue on his face. Listen to the president.
In the next 100 days, our bipartisan outreach will be so successful that even John Boehner will consider becoming a Democrat. After all, we have a lot in common. He is a person of color. Although not a color that appears in the natural world.
Beyond how funny that is, one of my favorite parts is Obama breaks up in the middle of this thing. How is that? I mean, as a viewer at home, when I watch this thing, I'm loving every minute. Cicely Strong from Saturday Night Live is the host this year, or the MC, or whatever you call it. There was one of the most incredible moments in American history after the fact when we learned that Barack Obama and Seth Meyers are making jokes about bin Laden during the dinner hours before Obama had authorized the raid on bin Laden and had played it totally straight. Are these things as much fun as they appear to be on television, or is it just this celebrity-laden whatever now?
No, I'll be honest. I'll be watching at home with Jonah King.
Oh, good for you.
I'm not a, I say this and people think, you know, I don't mean it the way it's... I'm not a fan of these things. That doesn't mean they're not great things. And I covered the White House for almost 10 years, and I went almost every year when I was covering the White House. I don't go anymore. It's an event. It does great things. It's a chance for the president to tell some jokes. I do think it's nice for the president and the news media to find venues once or twice a year to just have detente, not peace, because it has to be an adversarial relationship to some degree, but have peace and realize, you know, he's got a job, we've got a job, and let's just have a drink or a dinner and relax. However, this, in my view, this dinner has jumped the shark, then jumped the shark, then jumped the shark, then been taken over by the Kardashians, then been, you know, and it's just, it's too much. That's my personal opinion.
Wait a minute.
Completely disagree with me, who love them, and God bless them, they should go.
It's too much because the quality of the Hollywood star is sunk to the Kardashians, or because
what? No,
he means
it's a low-rent celebrity
thing. Is that what you mean, a low-rent celebrity thing?
I've got nothing against it. There are B-list celebrities and A-list celebrities who come, and they enjoy it, and that's fine. The main goal of this to begin with was to have a circuit breaker in the relationship with the President of the United States, which is a good thing to have, and B, to raise some money for scholarships to go to, you know, mostly inner city, low income kids who want to go to journalism school. And that is a great thing. I wish they would find a way to raise more money for scholarships and spend less time worrying about celebrities. The main venture of the dinner is still a good thing. It's just it's me. I've worked here a long time. I want a little bit more distance from this, and it may just be, you know, it's again, there are people in this town who you could book tomorrow who would say it's great, it's harmless, they love it. So it's just my personal opinion that it's just too much.
And I can't believe you're taking Joan over Kim Kardashian.
I'd much rather be home with my son.
Good for you, John King.
Okay, John.
That's why we love you. John, great to talk to you.
Have a very relaxing weekend with your kid. Thank you, John King.
Take care.
John King is CNN's chief national correspondent. He's also the host of Inside Politics, which you can catch weekdays at 7:30 a.m. and Sunday mornings at 8:30 on, of course, CNN. Okay, coming up, Charlie and the MBTA. Can Governor Charlie Baker fix it? Boston Globe business columnist Charlie DeYoung joins us for that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. In Massachusetts, the MBTA is the third rail of politics, and Governor Baker's plan to fix it is proving to be a shock to some in the legislature. But if anyone can reboot our ailing transportation system, Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Leung says that Baker's track record bodes well for the T. Shirley Leung, welcome back to Boston Public Radio. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Well, I heard that today is a free tea day. I guess you get some discounts on the aquarium and some other things, too. But I heard a lot of griping this morning that people had no idea it was free tea day and that they weren't even sure when they got to the tea that it was free. Did you hear anything like this?
I haven't.
Yeah. There are no signs and they wanted more information. It's going to be free tea day.
Sounds like Bostonians, right?
Yeah.
Complaining about something that's free.
Yeah. Somebody just emailed. They said they wish that it had been on the weekend because he might have benefited from a freebie. But today, you know, the only difference he noticed was people weren't holding up the bus by putting in cash. That was it.
So Shirley Leung, you make the case. I think you make the case, but you'll make it yourself since you wrote it, that Baker may be the right guy for the job, meaning the fixing of the T. What do you base that on?
Well, you know, I like to I write in my piece that this is that when it comes to crises, this is not his first time at the rodeo.
Mm-hmm.
When he was the CEO of Harvard Pilgrim, he was brought in and rescued, saved that company from, you know, it was on the brink of bankruptcy. And if you look at what he's doing to the T, fixing the T, he's kind of using the same playbook. He when he arrived at Harvard Pilgrim in 1999, he, you know, ordered up a rapid diagnosis, you know, to figure out what's going on, what are the problems. And then he, you know, developed a game plan. And then he, you know, put people in the right place to get it done. And this is exactly what he's trying to do with the T.
But there's one, well, there are a couple differences, I'd say. And we've had this discussion with the governor and then the candidate about this as well. You know what he took off the table as governor that he not only didn't take off the table, but used in with great ardor as head of Harvard Pilgrim? He raised premiums there big time because he needed new revenue to save this company. And we asked him as recently as we were here last Thursday, whatever day he was here, we weren't sure. Were new revenues, otherwise known as taxes, on the table, not on the table, ruled in? He says, I'm not going to raise taxes. That creates a totally different equation, don't you think?
Well, I mean, I have his plan, you know, admittedly, is kind of long on reform and short on revenue. And I mean, I think in the legislation that he released this week, he wants the ability to lift the fare cap.
Fare cap, yeah.
And so I think he does want to raise fare revenues, you know. I mean, he may not raise he does not seem ready to go for the gas tax, but he does want to raise raise revenues. Maybe it's through real estate deals, selling off land. I mean, I think there are a lot of ways to raise money.
You know, I was reading about that with the $6 million that Wynn paid over at the casino for that strip of land over there to get the entrance he wanted or whatever it was. I thought, wow, $6 million for this. How much more tea land could they make money off of? And also, it seems to me this is a political question. He's a Republican, a moderate Republican, we all know, but nonetheless, he's a Republican. When you have this report that says people are taking an average of 12 weeks between vacation and sick time and abusing family leave and fixing the trains is taking forever because of the deal that the union people have to do it and it's costing them a fortune. I mean, how politically can you rush in and say, we're going to raise taxes? It just seems untenable in his position.
Yeah, no, because I've gone round and round with him and on the gas tax, and he's not going to go there right now. But I don't think we're there at this point. I mean, I think what will be very interesting is because the business community was behind raising the gas, behind a gas tax.
Yep.
I mean, a huge gas tax, and the indexing. They wanted to keep that going, and I mean, to the point. I think John Fish, good old John Fish. I mean, I think he
Who's
gave.
That again?
I mean, he
you
was.
You were nice to John Fish.
We'll get to that in a minute.
He was very. I mean, I think he gave like $100,000 towards the Ballard referendum to try to, you know, keep the gas tax at a certain rate, and so I can see the business community coming around and really pushing for this. And maybe, I mean, not now, but maybe at some point Baker will come around on this. But I don't think this is the time to talk to him about it.
Let's stay on the tee for a second without getting too arcane here. I am convinced when David Palaiologos at Suffolk released the poll numbers the other day, I've never seen numbers like this for any elected official, 74-8 favorable over unfavorable. I think it's two things. One, to Baker's credit, he really has, I think, shown leadership, not so much product because he's only been there 3 months, but leadership. And I think even vast majority of Democrats agree with that, too. But I also think what's helped him hugely is the Democrats have not only attacked him, they've had a virtual love fest. Now, however, it appears it may end on this transportation thing. It's been reported in your paper, the two transportation chairs, McGee in the Senate and Bill Strauss in the House, are saying, well, wait a second. Why do we need the central element of this plan, this financial control board, between the T and the governor? Let the buck stop with the governor. Mm-hmm. And you spoke to, and I have to say, I have thought about it a lot. It seems to make sense to me. He got the 6 board members to resign. He's going to be in charge. He could appoint all new members to add to Stephanie Pollack as transportation secretary, who gets rave reviews. Why shouldn't the buck stop with him? Why should there be middle men and women?
I mean, I thought about this a lot yesterday because, why is there a fight over the fiscal control board? And, I mean, I see both sides of it. I mean, one hand, he's going to have control of the board. And so why do we need one more layer? But I also see his point of view, which is, the T is a mess. We need a kind of a SWAT team, a board, a fiscal control board, whose sole focus is to fix the T and, to untangle decades of problems. I mean, he's trying to think we need to think differently on how to fix the T. So I'm like, why not give him the chance to do that with a fiscal control board? It's temporary. It's for 3 to 5 years. This is what they did in Springfield, a decade ago. Brought them in. They had unusual powers. It'll be very interesting to see. I think some of the hesitation is that they're afraid that this board will have some power, some kind of unusual powers
abrogate union contracts or something?
Yes.
Or what?
Well, that's what it seems to me about, is that they're afraid that there's going to be a lot of pressure put on the Democratic legislature if this board starts messing with these contracts at the MBTA. And they have very, a good union there, and they will be strong.
I mean, I don't think they can touch the current contracts, but perhaps they could have an effect on future contracts. But I just feel like, we can't do everything the same way. We have to do something different. And so this fiscal control board seems like a different idea. Why don't we try it?
How many times do you get lobbied a day? On an average day, when it's clear to the people in the world in which you're writing on that particular day, whether it's T or Olympics, you've put out your calls, so everybody knows who's involved.
Yeah.
Shirley Leung's writing about this thing.
Yeah.
How many calls do you get? Well, how much lobbying happens of you?
I mean, it's not the number of calls, but it's the people who call and who like yesterday I actually got quite a few calls from key constituents that saying, this fiscal control board, you cannot be behind it. Please, I love your columns and I like you and I normally agree with you, but you cannot be behind this fiscal control board. It doesn't make any sense at all.
So your feet up on your desk at the Globe laughing when you get these calls, even though you're acting seriously on the line? What do you like?
I'm not laughing. I'm tortured because I have to write on deadline and I have to decide. And at the end of the day, I was like, why are we fighting over a board, a transportation board?
It makes total sense, Shirley.
Which
ignore
does?
Them. The fiscal control
to ignore them?
Board.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Marjorie has spoken. Let's move to a much, much, much simpler, less controversial topic you've written about 1,000 times, namely Boston 2024. One of the most interesting things you've written, and you have written a ton of stuff, Boston 2024's problem, it's not John Fish, it's us. I was offended before I even read it. So
and thousands of other readers.
So what was your basic thesis there, Shirley Leung, for those who haven't seen it?
Well, I guess I felt that we need to give the Olympics a chance. And I mean, we started the conversation today about how people were complaining about the free tea.
That's right.
We complain about everything.
We do.
And so they have, granted the Boston 2024 has not done a good job selling their plan, but we should listen to it. We shouldn't be against it before anything's been proposed yet.
Well, but isn't that part of the problem? When I hear the thing that puts me over the edge, I have to say, is when people in Boston 2024, and we're still waiting for them to show up. They're supposed to be here once a month. They canceled on short notice. We're waiting. But in any case, we have a messaging problem. Mm-hmm. It would seem to me you don't have a messaging problem. Number one, you've pledged there'll be no additional taxpayer funds other than transportation. Can you convince the public how that's going to happen? Two, you have all these people complaining, as I would, if I was in a community that would be affected. Mm-hmm. I want to know answers. And they keep saying, well, nothing's final. It's like a whack-a-mole kind of thing. So in many ways, by, I think, continuing to be not nearly as transparent as they need to be to win the public support, they're creating a situation where they could say what you just said, which is, give us a chance to get our act together. When do we get the details? When do we find out how you can guarantee, if you can? You know where I'm going with this thing?
I mean, you have to realize this is incredible. I mean, it takes a lot to get development done in Boston, right? And they are essentially doing, I don't know, they have to site 30 venues for, for Olympic events, and then build or at least come up with three places for like the stadium and the dorm or the athletic village and the media center. And so they've got a lot going on. And so if you think about it, it can take years, right, to develop a single skyscraper in Boston. So imagine they are doing all this in 2 months. And so it's going to be messy, and it's going to be hard for them to do. And they have not done a good job. I mean, it's a difficult project, complicated, and they've not done a good job. So that's why I was excited to hear about Larry Lucchino.
Yeah, but you should tell a story. It's a front page of your paper. Is it Mark Arsenault who wrote the
piece?
Yes, you should say what the deal is. It's an important moment, I think.
Yeah, no, you surely. Go ahead.
Yeah, you should.
So, actually, I wrote about this too. I say in that same piece, my original piece about John Fish, I said it's not, us, but they do need new leadership and a new public face. And I said, we need like a Larry Bird with an MBA. And Larry Lucchino is kind of the next best thing for this. I mean, I wish I thought about this. I mean, he is a major business sports figure, not only in Boston as part of the Red Sox organization, but he, built Camden Yards in Baltimore.
Right?
He also built the Padres Stadium in San Diego. So he knows how to develop sports stadiums. He knows how to do this.
He also knows how to talk, by the way. The guy is, I think, really good, even with a combative public on Red Sox and related things.
I mean, he had to sell the stadium idea to the citizens of San Diego. And I think there was even a referendum back there. So he knows how to construct giant sports complexes. So that's great. And also, I was thinking, does he know? Of course he knows sports. We know him at the Red Sox, right? He has 3 World Series rings. He has a Super Bowl ring because he also worked for the Redskins. And he went to Princeton, and he was on the basketball team, and he has a Final Four ring.
Yale or Princeton?
Princeton. He went to my alma mater.
He did?
He played with Bill Bradley.
He did not.
He did.
He's short, too.
He must be a point guard, right?
Yeah, he's not very tall.
I didn't
tall.
Know he played with Bradley.
Yeah, so Final Four ring, Super Bowl ring, and three World Series
rings. So does this mean, by the way, when I was reading the story this morning, what I couldn't tell is this one of these trial balloon things where the Boston 2024 wants to get a sense, how's the public reacting?
Yeah.
Or is this just the first step and tomorrow, 2 days from now, we find out he's going to take a leave from the Red Sox and he's going to be the de facto chair or face of 2024? What do you think is going on?
I do think it's a trial balloon because he's kind of the bad cop in the Red Sox organization, right? And so I think people – but I actually think by having his name out there, my reaction was like, wow, this is a serious business executive, a serious sports executive who might be behind our Olympic bid. It gives it instant credibility.
Did anybody think of Mitt Romney in your reporting?
Mitt Romney? I in terms of taking over this thing?
I'll tell you why.
Well, okay,
I should have taken a picture of Shirley's face right there,
so
but I was
Mitt
too
Romney,
slow.
Okay, I'm sorry. Mitt Romney My thinking is, I'm sure they've asked Mitt Romney. I'm not
to
sure
to do something.
To do something,
yeah. Right?
If he wanted to take over Boston 2024, I think he would be doing this.
Okay.
I don't think he wants to do something he's already done before.
Here's my thing, and again, I'm a cynical person. I've lived here all my life, and I've seen all. I've earned my cynicism. To me, Larry Lucchino, he's a great guy, but he's another one of the insider boys' club. All the wealthy people, all the insiders, going to get a great deal. You guys had a story in the Globe in the business section yesterday about this poor little couple out there in Roxbury, Dorchester, wherever they were, in a total panic that they're going to be booted out of their apartment. And this apparently has happened in all these other cities because the rich and connected are going to have a wonderful time at the Olympics, and the poor little guy that's the custodian and his poor wife, who's whatever she's doing, are going to wind up living in Chelsea or Revere or Lynn. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And I think that's the problem. And to me, Larry Lucchino solves none of that unless you're a Red Sox fan. And I don't think we're all Red Sox fans, but he's just more the same to me.
He feels different to me.
To me too.
He feels different. And wait, where were you going with Mitt Romney? Because Mitt Romney doesn't solve that problem.
Because I look at the person in there.
Just an average guy.
Just an average guy, you know. I was like, what's...
Because he fixed the corruption at the Olympics. I think whatever you think about Mitt Romney.
Wait,
didn't
he run for president? Wait,
did.
Can we rewind the tape on the 47% video? Isn't he the classic one percenter? I mean, he would be because that's the problem with the Boston, another problem with the Boston 2024. It's become class warfare.
Yeah.
It is the one percenters, you know, imposing their vision on our city. And I think Mitt Romney, I know everybody
But he's the one percenter that gave like 20% of his money to charity or something like that. I mean, he's an upstanding.
Yeah, people do see him as the ultimate insider. And see, it's interesting you say that.
I don't think so at all. He's a Republican.
The all-stars.
Not in Massachusetts. He's not the ultimate
Charlie
insider.
Charlie Baker is the governor of Massachusetts.
I know
what
that, but I don't think, with due respect, I don't think people see him that way.
But, you know, they were celebrating the other day. I happen to agree with you, Shirley Leung, on Lucchino's appeal. I think he does have a thing with the public in a good way. But the flip side is when they picked all these stars the other day, I'm looking down the list.
Yeah.
Who doesn't love Larry Bird? Zillionaire who doesn't live here.
Yeah.
Who doesn't love David Ortiz? Yeah. Zillionaire doesn't live here. And then the head of all these investment firms.
Yeah.
However,
exactly.
Speaking of the one percenters, I know at the other night when your boss, Brian McGrory, moderated a discussion between John Henry, your other boss, and Jack Welch, former head of GE, you introduced Jack Welch. I had him on television right before he and his wife were on television with me. And I asked them about the Olympics and how they felt. I assume because they were big time business people, one percenters, like all the other business people, one percenters, they'd be all in. Mm-hmm. Listen to what they said. Or don't. Do we have that? Jack Welch, Jack and Susie Welch, that's coming imminently.
Should Boston be home of the Olympic Games in 2024, starting with you, Jack Welch, and then we'll go to Susie?
Can they solve the traffic problems?
Is that your major concern?
Well, the overall congestion. I mean, it's a big bite.
You don't sound like as on board as a lot of business leaders in this community. Am I judging your position fairly?
I'd like to know more.
How about you, Susie Welch? Don't say what he says.
My understanding.
She won't.
My understanding is that there is a large swell of people in Boston who don't want it. And so I think that if you can't have the Olympics here, if most people don't want to have them, the city, the residents have to be bought into something like that because the city will be turned upside down by it.
You know, as soon as I heard them say it, and I was surprised by both of them saying that, and I said to myself, well, it's not so surprising. Right now, even though they're of this business community, they're not in it. And it seems to me that virtually every major business leader is in one of two positions right now. They're either on board because of whatever. They either believe it or because they don't want to disappoint their business colleagues. Or they're silent because they don't want to undercut their business colleagues. And finally, two business people who don't need anything here. Again, they're connected. I mean, I thought that was a pretty powerful statement from a wildly respected business leader and his wife. No?
I mean, I feel like they reflect kind of the kind of isolate the Governor Baker approach, which is, you know, they're just asking questions. I mean, they're skeptical, but they're interested in the Olympics. I guess we actually also asked an Olympic question.
What'd they say?
I was trying to recall it. I don't think he seemed more positive. We taped it for Nessun on Saturday night, and so I got to.
You're obviously paying very close attention.
Well,
so sure.
But you know, John Henry spoke.
What do you say about
the Olympics?
He hasn't taken a position. Yeah, I assume because of the Globe.
I feel okay talking about it because
it was a public event.
Yeah, it was a public event.
What did he say?
He he also was of the kind of Governor Baker approach, which was, you know, I like the Olympics, but we need to see a plan, and I don't feel like we have enough details from the plan. And I guess the Globe is also somewhat affected by the Olympics, because the Globe property is across the street from a potential.
Not to mention the fact, if the Olympics come, I think you're going to sell about 10 million more papers. Then, I mean, isn't that a fairly obvious thing?
Well, I don't know. Do you think there'll be print newspapers back in 2024?
I wouldn't tell your boss that. Hey, before
that's a
you
very
go,
good point. Our days are numbered.
Hey, Shirley Leung, business columnist extraordinaire for the Boston Globe. Before you leave, in 1 minute, Marty Welch is joining us at 12 o'clock. Mm-hmm. Give us a 30-second review of how you think he has handled this whole Boston 2024 thing, and then we'll play for him what you said. Go ahead.
That's right. Put you right in the spot, Shirley.
It's interesting.
Leung,
when she's writing in
please
her office, she's fine.
27 and a half seconds. I'm only kidding.
Time is running.
You know, I mean, first of all, I think it was good that he made a decision to get behind the bid, because we couldn't actually go for the Olympics. We couldn't even put a serious bid in without him involved. I think he was a little too enthusiastic in the early part of the year. I mean, I think he should have been more measured because people are looking to him to kind of protect the city, not to be kind of overrun by the interests of Boston 2024. But now I think he's corrected his kind of stance, and he's just created a new office for Olympic planning, and he's kind of gotten a little more stern and about Boston 2024. And he was really, I mean, it was right for him to get involved with when the Patrick Salah, the transparency issue, and say,
he called for it. He said, release all the data.
Right, release all this out. So that was a good call.
Shirley
Fair
Leung.
Enough, Shirley Leung.
Thank you
Great
so much for
you.
Coming in. Thanks. Love talking to you and love your column. Shirley Leung is a business columnist for the Boston Globe.
And next time she comes, she can take her coat off, too. How's that for a deal?
She can take her coat off.
Okay,
well, it's a little cold in here. Up next, Callie Crossey joins us to talk about the stories that flew under the radar. This is 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Joining us for a truncated Friday review of the stories likely missed is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. You can listen to it Sunday night. You can listen to her now with us. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Jim. I'm Marjorie.
Okay, well, apparently Jim Browdy is obsessed with Don Lemon from CNN. Apparently you're obsessed with him as well. Can we hear what's going on with Don? What's the big brouhaha, please, about Don Lemon?
No, I know Jim is, so I sent him a note saying, because I know you admire him so much,
he does.
Don Lemon. So, yeah, not. This is a big piece that was done on something called the Anchorman, the Legend of Don Lemon. And it's just a whole thing about who is Don Lemon and why does he make these gaffes and what's going on there. And they just get more and more crazy as you read the piece. And
the gaffes do?
Yeah. You think to yourself, and what? So the guy's describing their lunch, and it starts off with they're ordering sorbet, in which Don Lemon tells the interviewer, you know, it's pronounced sorbet. And the guy starts questioning himself, thinking, gee, all these years I thought it was sorbet. And then the waiter comes over and he says, we'll have sorbet. And the waiter says, no, it's pronounced sorbet.
Oh, my God.
But can I tell you, it's the first time I ever felt warmly towards Don Lemon, because apparently, according to the writer, he was totally, okay, I got it wrong, then I'll take whatever
well, you know
it is.
What? He should have stayed. Was this in GQ?
Yeah, GQ.
That's where he belongs, because he is a cute guy. He's gorgeous. I mean, he should have stayed.
He could do an afternoon talk show.
A modeling career. He would have been terrific.
And right before I read that story, I do what I always do, is I go to the comments on the story. Here's the first one. I am also gay. I despise people. Well, forget that one. Don Lemon is an educated idiot who happens to be on TV and is gay. Those are the only two things that he is famous for. However, he makes a career on being black. He is most definitely not a genius. And this is my favorite line from the same person. The writer of the story is named Taffy. I rest my case. Which that is the person's name.
Yes.
It is Taffy. Oh, no. Is the name of the Taffy. Brodesser Ackner is the name of the person.
I was like, really? The only thing I would say is that, you know, sometimes these people that wander the earth vaguely do harm. And so that's what I think about him. And the quote in the piece from Jeff Zucker, to me, says it all. Let me put it this way, says Jeff Zucker. There's certainly a lot of interest in Don Lemon, and that's a good thing for Don and CNN. You know, Don is a little bit of a lightning rod. Frankly, we need a little bit of lightning. And I read that because Don started off getting more attention to himself by ragging on black black people, I don't appreciate it. You know what? You know, make your reputation somewhere else. And then he, you know, went on from there. Oh, you know, well, you know, Bill O'Reilly is right. Black people are really need to get themselves together. Really, Don?
Oh. Let me just say one thing, and then we got to move on to what you're doing Sunday. Yeah. I mean, for those who haven't heard my rants against him, the thing that put me over the edge, his behavior with that victim of Bill Cosby was reprehensible. And in my opinion, I never think people should be removed from their jobs. He should have been removed from his job. Having said that, what's happening Sunday night on Under the Radar with Kelly Crossley?
Well, we're doing a number of things, but one of the pieces that we're looking at is a story about, in the context right now, we're seeing video by citizens of all kinds of police misconduct, right? And so the guy in South Carolina is named a hero for having taken that video of the man being murdered by the police officer. But if you try to shoot police officers in Massachusetts, you risk being jailed, even though it is not a crime. What has happened is a lot of people who have taken videos and the police officers have not appreciated it have arrested them on the wiretapping law. It is illegal to audio tape someone privately, but this is videotape. So it's a sort of situation where, you know, the technology has advanced. There have been a number of avowed activists who've tested this, but there have been some other people who are just your regular Joe citizens who've gotten caught up in this and, you know, had bad things happen to them. It's really interesting. But just to be clear, the First Circuit Court of Appeals, because one of these cases, they mentioned many, went all the way there, ruled that it is a constitutionally protected right to videotape police carrying out their duties in public. It is not a crime to videotape police. Here's the thing that I put to my guests, and that is this. Periscope and Meerkat, as you know, these new apps in which you can upstream. In the past...
Live.
In the past, people would take these videos and then, you know, they'd have to upload them someplace. But there have been a few instances where the cops have taken the phone, smashed it, or taken the memory stick. In this case, if you just Periscope from the beginning, it's already live.
Yeah.
You know? So that's really interesting. Now, there's legal issues all around and ethical, don't get me wrong. But, you know, that would, I'll be interested to see what happens there because you can see what happened then. There's no more discussion about it that you took my phone, you stomped on it, whatever.
Is it amazing how in the last, I know we got to go, but in the last, what, month or 2 months, it's all about the cameras. Well, I guess starting in, not in Ferguson, post-Ferguson, all about the cameras.
Exactly.
Kelly, thanks. Sorry it was brief today. We'll listen Sunday night.
Coming up, the mayor of Boston is here for his monthly appearance. He's going to be here for an hour, taking our questions and yours. He's next. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. And here with us in Studio 3 for his monthly appearance is the mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh. Good enough to take our questions and yours for the next hour. You can call him at 877-301-897. You can send him an email at bpr@wgbh.org. And a ton of you have already tweeted him. Hello, Mr. Mayor.
How are you?
Excellent.
We're very well, Mr. Mayor. Did you take advantage of the free MBTA service today? Did you take ride around or anything, get the free donuts?
No, I didn't. I probably should have, but I've been in City Hall all day, most of the day, and then I had to come out here, and then I had to be back in City Hall right after this, and so maybe later on tonight.
Which side are you on in this whole, I don't know if it's a dust-up yet, but a potential dust-up between your former Democratic colleagues, the Democratic chairs of the Transportation Committee, and Baker? The governor has filed this thing saying, I want a financial control board to take over the T. Mm-hmm. Bill Strauss, House Chair, who you worked with for years, Tom McGee, Senate Chair, say, essentially, why do we need a middle person? Why do we need a financial control board? Let the governor, let the buck stop directly with the governor. Who's right in this situation?
I mean, I haven't taken a position in this, and I know a little bit about legislation. I don't know everything. I know it was filed the other day, and I've been reading the comments from Tommy and Bill Strauss, my former colleagues in the House. And I think the governor is concerned about all of the things happening at the T. I think the financial control board or some type of fiscal management is needed at the T. But I think they need to go deeper. I think the bottom line is going to come down to infrastructure money and how do you come up with the money. I know that in the legislation, it really is about reorganizing the boards and reorganizing the management side of it. But it's going to come down to, at the end of the day, come down to dollars and cents going into the T. I think that the debt of the big dig, which, again, in this legislation, doesn't necessarily take the debt away from the T. They still have to pay for the T, but it's done a little differently. They designed it a little differently. I think it's going to come down to how do you get money into the MBTA to fix the infrastructure.
So we asked Charlie Baker this last Thursday because his Stephanie Pollack had been on my television show and said, quote, the governor has not ruled out raising revenue. I played that for the governor. He said, actually, taxes are not on the table. Virtually everybody else other than the governor, and it sounds like you too, think that ultimately the complete fix for the T is going to include some revenue raising. Are you amongst them?
Well, I mean, it's either some type of revenue raising or cost shifting, and I think the money's going to have to come out of other programs in the budget. And the legislature next week starts the budget process, so it's not going to happen this year. So you might have to take away from one program to put into another to come up with the money. I mean, there was a perfectly great way of having revenue coming into the T and doing infrastructure with the indexing of the gas tax, and the voters of Massachusetts said, no, we don't want that.
Including the governor.
Yeah, so that's an issue. I mean, that's a problem. And when you have that, and that was a dedicated revenue source for transportation. So if you were driving, the tax, the 2 cents you were paying, and the indexing of that was going to go into transportation. And I think that overturn, and I supported that legislation as a rep, one of my last votes, but I also supported the ballot in question so that indexing would stay. And it's a big loss, and it's going to be a bigger loss as years come here.
One last question on that, Mr. Mayor. Our number is 877-301-8970. If Charlie, I know you speak to him a lot, and he's spoken highly of you here, and I'm sure elsewhere. I know you have as well. If he said to you, tell me candidly, should I raise the gas tax as part of this package I'm filing, what would you say to him?
I'd say you absolutely have to look at it. But again, the problem's going to be is on the heels of the ballot initiative. I think you're better off doing an educational program to people out in the street to understand that what the gas tax, raising the gas tax was. Just real quick, 2001, when we raised taxes in Massachusetts, the largest tax increase in the history of Massachusetts, as in 2002, I should say. If you remember, I believe the Herald, the Globe, the Worcester Telegram and Gazette, all of the papers around the Commonwealth were saying raise taxes because we had to. I think if people understand that the money is going directly into infrastructure, not just MBTA, but roads and bridges, they will understand and say, okay. I think what happened was when the ballot question was on the ballot, you know, the governor at the time was opposed to it, and it was came up in conversation, a few debates, and I think it got caught up in the gubernatorial race.
Mayor Walsh, you're a big labor guy. There's something called the Pacheco Law. Yep. Correct me if I'm wrong. What the Pacheco Law basically says is you have to hire union labor.
No.
Okay, tell me what it is.
Pacheco Law is a way to prevent privatization from coming into the MBTA, and there was a big issue of privatization problems, and the Pacheco Law protected against privatization, and I think that when you have a public entity and you're talking about bringing in privatizing some of the services there, more often than not, the services aren't delivered to the ability of what it was beforehand. And there's ways of reorganizing the MBTA. And I think going after the Pacheco Law is not one of the ways, in my opinion. We've raised the threshold on the Pacheco Law in the past. I believe we did it before 2 years before I left the legislature. But I think by simply outright removing the Pacheco Law, I think that's not the way to go.
Okay, so...
And that has nothing to do with the common union or anything else. I just think when we look at all these different industries and we talked about deregulation and privatizing utilities and all this other stuff, the idea behind it was the costs were going to go down.
Right.
Well, look at your cable bill, look at your gas bill, look at your Edison bill, and tell me after deregulation if your cable, gas, and water bill, not water separate, have gone down. They haven't gone down. They've gone up. And by the way, they're going up another double digits in the next couple of years.
But one of the things this report did come out with and find was that because union mechanics for the MBTA are required to do all the work on the trains, that it's costing the MBTA in Boston a lot more money than it is in all these other cities and towns. But despite that, you'd say... We're not going to change that.
I don't think that's accurate. I think that what's happened in the past is that the MBTA has shipped out cars, buses to outside of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to get fixed. They get sent back here, and the workforce of the MBTA has to fix the buses that were fixed when they went out. And I think that there's an opportunity here to revamp some of that. But I think if you're going to take on the MBTA, I think the Pacheco Law is one of those hot-button issues that if there can be a savings there. I don't necessarily see the savings in the Pacheco Law. When you talk about the review board of looking at the finances, is that needed? The governor feels it's needed. He thinks it's going to help him do a better job. You have to look at that. I think when you talk about the Pacheco Law, if the savings aren't there and the cost savings aren't there, then I don't understand it. And I think that, you know, when I spoke in front of this panel that the governor put together, is very appreciative of the opportunity. And he has to make tough decisions. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
I mean, we had long conversations about the T going down when it went down. And for a guy that was 38 days on the job having to deal with a transportation system breaking down, that's something you don't want to do. So very difficult situation for him then. very difficult situation now to make changes that aren't going to be popular. But, I'm not sure if the Pacheco's the way to
okay,
go.
Okay, but one last thing on this, and then we'll get to the calls. You know, there's a perception here, right or wrong, that the Pacheco law is causing problems. There's a perception here that when you have people taking an average of 11 weeks time off during the year, whether it's vacation or sick time or whether
family,
the extent to which people
leave,
are abusing that there has to be some big-time serious reform before you come and ask for taxes.
Well, or the management has to do their job.
Yeah.
And I think that the management has to look into this and make adjustments and make fixing. I mean, it's similar to in 2010, we had legislation at the State House that was allowing level 4 and level 5 schools to go in and change the system in there and move teachers out. And I asked the question at the time, and the chair of the committee, Marty Walls, at the time, Education Committee, was asking the city of Boston, what do you do for teachers that are underperforming? Are you documenting them? Are you moving teachers out where you can legally do it? And the answer was they weren't doing it. So there's ways, you know, management's there for a reason. And I think if you have a good, strong management team in place, then you can see real changes happening.
One last thing before we get to the calls. The number's 877.
You said one last thing five times.
Okay, seven more things before we get to the calls. 877-301-8970. We invited tweets, as we always do when you're here. The vast majority of them were on one topic. Do you have any idea what the topic would be?
Well, it's not snow on the streets.
No, so what would it be?
It's the Olympics.
Exactly. We'll get to that in a few minutes. But you know what number two was? Actually, a fairly distant two, but there were a lot of them. And
the
I know
Patriots
it's
Parade?
No, something actually you care. Something that you care a lot about is what happens to the people who displaced after the fiasco with Long Island Bridge.
Okay.
Obviously, the final piece taken out. I know you're behind the schedule that you were hoping to be in terms of replacement beds and facilities. Where are things now?
Well,
what's the immediate future look like?
The issue that I think people are concerned about, and let me just quickly go through this because I know we want to take calls. Our shelter opened, I believe, another 150 beds this week.
Oh, it did.
Roughly that. And before I misquote, we'll get the numbers in a minute for you.
Okay, sure.
I was actually over there yesterday morning. I went over and saw the shelter being built out. As far as the homeless population in Boston, we're making sure people have a safe place to be and you know, a warm place in the cold winter. And thank God this winter, I was worried every single day and every single night that we would lose a homeless person to the streets, and we didn't. In saying that, we still have to continue to build out our shelter. Our transition programs, when I say our transition programs, the one the cities runs, I believe they're opening in the next, if they're not open already, they're going to be opening in the next few days. So all the transition programs are going. Where we have a problem is we have a problem with the private detox programs trying to place them. That's where our problem is. And one in particular, Victory Programs, which we're trying to make sure they have places for it. We thought we had identified a place in Roxbury, the city, and we were going to buy it and we were going to convert it over so private detoxes could be run out of there. That fell through. We're working, Victory Programs is working with Department of Neighborhood Development trying to identify some locations. They're a great, great entity, great company. They do some wonderful life-saving work, that's our problem. And trying to locate a detox, people just don't want detox in the neighborhood. Although every neighborhood has people with problems with drugs and alcohol, but they just don't want the programs in their district. So we're trying to find the right place for it. So if anyone's listening, you own property in the city, and you're willing to have a conversation with the city in Victory Programs about possibly maybe an old a building or something that you're looking to get rid of and you want to do something and help us out, I would love to have you give us a call in City Hall.
Let's go to the calls. This is the mayor of the city of Boston, Marty Walsh. He'll be with us and you until 1 o'clock. Mr. Mayor, let's
before
go
I get the call, by Friday, which is today, mm-hmm. We have an additional 150 beds open at the shelter. We have 14 new toilets, 6 new showers. We're putting in a whole new bank of showers there. So right now in the shelter, by the end of today, we will have close to 250 beds replaced of our 400-plus beds over Long Island.
Great. Right. Let's go to the calls, Mr. Mayor.
Let's go to Sal in West Roxbury.
Hello, Sal.
Hey, how you doing, Mr. Mayor?
Good, Sal.
Good, good, good. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, pal.
You and Stevie Lynch are the best Democrats we got in this state.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. Hey, one quick question here about Millennium Park. I got three.
Yep.
There's construction going on over there, as you well know, and you're doing an awesome job. But is there any chance of building a street hockey rink in that construction over there for the kids? And the other thing is, Millennium Park in the wintertime is F's. It just, you can't use it because of the snow we had. Why don't you get somebody up there to plow it and to pay for it, charge the people from Newton and Brookline who use it?
Give me the third one and I'll answer it.
That's it.
All right, the first one, the hockey rink. Do me a favor. Get in touch with our office, Enabled Services. I'm not sure exactly what the plans are for the park. I know there's been master plans, and the people, I know there's a committee that's working with Millennium Park and really pushing the reconstruction of Millennium Park and the additions of Millennium Park. So I just suggest you call. I don't know if there's a hockey rink slated for there or not. And I know there's a lot of great street hockey in West Roxbury. I was at the Shamrock Shootout a couple weeks ago. It was great. So just if you don't mind, follow up on that. As far as the snowpats, one of the reasons, I mean, to be honest with you, we weren't able to get to all the properties we own. We were able to clean around the park, but not in the park. But in this year's budget, we're putting on a second crew to go into the parks, to clean the parks at night. And it's going to give us a lot more capacity to do a lot more work next year. So that's really the reason why we didn't answer it. And as far as backcharging people to use the park, I mean, it's a public park. We can't and we can't discriminate whether I know what you're saying about Newton and I think you said
Brookline.
I was just
can't charge them a toll because if I promoted that, I wouldn't be your favorite Democrat.
Sal, thank you for the goal. You know, speaking of cleanup, you announced,
park.
I think today, yesterday, there's some annual citywide cleanup thing.
Yeah,
what's going on with that?
Boston Shines. It started many years ago in Boston. Last year, we tried to kind of reinvigorate it. When it first started, there was thousands of people out in the street cleaning the streets. And then over the years, it kind of fell back. And this year, we're doing 3 weekends starting this weekend in Alston, Brighton, Fenway, High Park, Mission Hill, Rosendale, and West Roxbury. Having city employees and people come out and through the neighborhood groups. And we're going to have thousands of people in the street cleaning the streets this weekend. Next weekend, we're doing Bay Village, Chinatown, Dorchester, Mattapan, and South End. And then the third weekend of May 8th and 9th, we're doing Back Bay, Beacon Hill, Charlestown, Downtown, East Boston, Jamaica Plain, North End, South Boston, West End. So we're broken the city into three sections to really get out there and clean the city. It's actually pretty clean. I mean, when you look, I've been driving around a lot. It's pretty clean right now, which I'm very happy about. But we're really going to be getting into lots, into parks, into streets, into gutters, into sidewalks, and really trying to do a real major cleanup of the city. And they're trying to encourage last year people to take pride in your street, take pride in your neighborhood, businesses, clean in front of your businesses. You can't just solely leave it up to the city of Boston to clean the street. It's not just our job. It's everyone that lives here's job. So we're asking people, let's make our city the cleanest. So this weekend and the next 3 weekends, we're going to really be doing big, big work on cleaning.
Great. Back to the calls, Mr. Mayor.
How about we go to Bob in Charlestown?
Hello, Bob.
Hi. Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak with you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you.
The reason I'm calling is I abut a very historic park, the training field, also known as Winthrop Square. It's supposedly the second oldest park in the country. It's classified as a passive use park, not a dog park. And we have tremendous problems with the barking and the playing of dogs in the park, despite signage for owners to keep their dogs on leash. As soon as they hit the park, they snap the leash off. The dogs run. It tears up the grass. The dogs play. They have a lot of barking. I tried calling the Parks Department. Couldn't speak with anyone there, but they transferred me to the animal control folks.
Yep.
So I asked them if they could come by. They explained their limitations. And I said, do me a favor, when you come by, please just don't ask people nicely, because there are already signs there. Please cite them. Surprisingly, they said, actually, we can't issue any tickets right now because of something or other. So my macro question is, how can you solve the dog issue or the dog owner issue in beautiful parks like this?
Yep. Let me first of all, let me find out and see. I'll find out why the reason they can't cite people for not having their dogs on leashes. I know code enforcement can, so I'm going to work on that. It's a bigger issue in the city with people allowing their dogs to kind of run freely and also not pick up after their dogs. In a lot of the parks, they're not dog parks. It's not just in Charlestown.
Right.
That people let their dog in a playing field where kids and seniors are and run around and go to, you know, do their thing. And then kids are playing there that afternoon. So it's a bigger issue. It's something that our animal control office, which we are revamping. We had some problems there a year ago when I took over. We had to make some major adjustments in there, and we're getting back on track. But also code enforcement. So let me follow up with code enforcement. They should be out there writing tickets for dogs not on leashes, number one. And two, anybody who their dog you know, does their business in parks should be written up as well if they don't pick up. So let me work on that. And I would suggest if when you get a chance, give Tom McKay a call in Office of Neighborhood Services. Tell him we spoke on the radio today. He's your liaison over in Charlestown, and we can focus on certain parks as well.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Bob.
Bob, thank you for the call. 877-301-8970. Is First Night going to survive?
I hope so. I mean, I think we're going to make sure it happens. The issue is that 3 years ago, the company that ran First Night went out of business. And prior to that, they were coming to my office as a state rep to try and get a line item for it because it costs money.
Buttons don't come close. I didn't know the other day. Like a third of the actual cost.
The buttons don't. It's really the sponsorships. Yeah. And so Man Menino kept First Night alive 2 years ago. And then when I took over last year, I kept First Night alive because it's such a big day night in Boston. It's a great economic engine for the city for that particular night, and thousands of people come into Boston. So we're not in the business of running big venues like that. So we partner with people like the Marathon. So we put on RFP to see if there's interest in a company coming in and actually running First Night. I think with the kind of the rejuvenation in arts and culture in the city of Boston, you might have a company now willing to come in, because it really is. It's there's a festival at the Heinz Auditorium. There's a parade down Boylston Street. There's a lights show. Mm-hmm. There's sculptures, fireworks. So really, I'm hoping that companies will say, listen, this is something a venue would like to do here. Maybe even expand it for a couple of days beforehand. That's fine. We're just going to look at the interest in it and see what happens.
But if a company doesn't exhibit that interest, it's cooked?
I wouldn't say it's going to be cooked this year, but it's going to be severely downsized, and we're going to have to really figure out what we do, because it is about raising money and it's about capacity. And our Office of Special Events, we don't have the staff there to run these mega events, and that's a big event where you have thousands of people coming in. And when it comes to public safety, we Commissioner Evans and the police department can do their work, and the other public safety officials. But when you're talking about actually putting the events together and getting all the different, you know, the firework display in itself is a big enterprise. So it's a matter of hopefully there'll be some interest, and I think there will be some interest.
877-301-8970 is our number. He's the mayor of the city of Boston. Mr. Mayor, we can go back to the phones.
How about Jamal?
Hey, Jamal, how are you?
In Roxbury.
All right. Good afternoon, folks.
Hey there.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
You're welcome, Jamal. How are you?
Thanks, good. Now, number one, great release, and your team did a great job. Kudos to Sean Blue and team with the Workforce Diversity Report. Now, my question is, you've already done more in your first year than in 20 years previous. In terms of appointments and diversifying the cabinet. So now what's the strategy, and like, how are you going to be able to do more and reach out to the people outside of the appointments, number one? And then number two, with the national discussion on police, do you think that there is the political will, or that it really, are we finally in Boston? Could we actually end up getting a civilian review board and tangible changes on the Boston Police Department under your administration?
All right, thanks, Jamal. Let me do the first question, then I'll do the second one. The first one, those of you that are listening, you might not understand, we did a report on diversity in the city of Boston, people of color and also women. We looked at ages, we looked at pay scale, we looked at numbers of people working in different departments, and we broke it down by department. So, for example, I'll give you a quick overview. Women in the city of Boston make up 56% of the workforce in the city of Boston. If you look at it as 18,000 people say, well, that's fabulous. But if you take the school department out, that number goes down to 26%. You know, when you look at pay scales, we see some discrepancies between women and men. When you look at overall pay scales between African American and Latino and Asian, we really broke it down very, very, very precise. Sean Blue and Frieda Bransfield did an incredible job with this report. This report is a blueprint for us to use now moving forward as far as pay equity and also looking forward as far as race diversity within the rank and file and also the leadership of City Hall. So what we do now is Sean Blue and Frieda are going to be sitting with they already have sat with cabinet chiefs, but department heads, as far as hiring processes, where are we looking for people, and creating a pipeline for employment in City Hall. As people leave, how do we replace people to make sure that the city truly reflects the city of Boston, the people that work for the city? So it's a good blueprint, and we're going to be able to do this report yearly. We'll probably do some type of form of it, maybe quarterly, just to see where we're going. But I'm going to be able to sit down with Commissioner of Public Works and say, listen, last year your numbers were this year your numbers are worse, your numbers are better, you're doing a good job, and be able to kind of go through each department as a time and use it as a template. It's the first time we've ever done this. Some private companies have done it in the recent past, but city's never done it like this before, so it's something brand new. The report is public and it's available, so anyone who wants a report, we can get a copy of the report. You can get a copy of the report and actually see where we are. As far as the Civilian Review Board, and you and I, Jamal, have talked about this, we've changed the co-op board in the city of Boston.
What's that?
It's a civilian, it's a review board, but it's appointed, the mayor appoints three individuals mm-hmm. to be on there. And we're looking at the co-op board now. They're meeting to talk about what tools they might need to be able to do proper investigations of any type of police misconduct or potential misconduct that's happening in the city of Boston. So we're moving forward with the co-op board to strengthen it. In the past, members of the co-op board that are no longer on the board in the past have said, you know, basically this board was just kind of a board. It didn't do anything. And we're trying to change that mindset.
Jamal, thanks for your
and
call.
Reality, not mindset. Change that, make it a reality that people like Jamal. Jamal is very active in the community in Roxbury, in Dorchester, Mattapan, and we've had conversations about this. And I don't know if he's still on the line.
No,
but,
he's off.
Blackstonian, the
you
best
know, side. Yeah, and we've had conversations. We've had real good, honest conversations, and he's not afraid to push me, and he's not afraid to push us. And I think it's a conversation that, you know, we talked about the co-op board and seeing how we move forward with it. You know, I think we spend a lot of time, and I make sure that we spend a lot of time in the community, reaching out to the community so that we don't have incidents like we had in the aftermath of Ferguson, the aftermath of New York. And thank God, in Boston, we haven't had that. There's still work to be done, but we work very hard on the sensitivity of our police officers and making sure that you know, young people of color don't feel targeted in their neighborhood. And that's something that we have to end. And there's still work to be done, and we're going to continue to work on it.
Mayor Walsh, where are you on body cameras?
Right now, I mean, the way the whole body camera discussion came up, and it was kind of right after the president actually announced a program. I'm not sure if it's set up yet, a grant program that they could, meaning police departments, could apply for the federal government to get reimbursed for body cameras. You know, we're open to looking at the idea. You know, in some cases it works, some cases it doesn't work, and we'd have to see how we'd roll something like that out in the city of Boston, because not all of our police officers can run around with body cameras on our detectives and our drug unit guys and ladies and things like that. So, but it's something that, you know, we've had some conversations about it. We haven't done a deep look at it.
You know, I'm sort of surprised that you're still as ambivalent as you are about that. Your police commissioner was here the other day, and he expressed the same sentiments you did, but said, and I'll paraphrase, but he basically said, but regardless of what I think, they're coming. But being the mayor of a city where I think you'd agree, I know it wasn't the body camera, had there not been video of the shooting of Officer Moynihan and the subsequent shooting by the police of Angelo West, the perpetrator there, there could have been a Ferguson here. I'm not saying it would have been justified, obviously, but the video and the release of the video to the community leaders within 24 hours, I think, is what caused the city to get through this the way it did. So wouldn't that convince you that and by the way, I have a lot of concern about cameras too, but the more cameras in and around cops, the better?
Yeah, no, I mean, it simply just isn't a question of body cameras. It's also a question of how do you implement it, who wears them,
sure.
who pays for the cost of them, who upgrades them. I mean, we have a radio system in Boston. Now, they're not cameras, but we have a radio system, our police department, that has to be upgraded. It's a $51 million item to upgrade the radio system, and we're doing it incrementally in this year's budget. So we have some major capital needs as well. We're also instituting this year a cadet program, something that hasn't been in existence since 2009, where we can get people on the police force and keep our police force diversified. So there's a lot of other costs there as well. So, you know, as this program gets rolled out, I think Worcester's doing a program. I think other place of doing programs, we're going to be looking at the numbers, and not just, I mean, having a body camera on somebody sounds like a great idea. It's not simply going out and buying a $10 camera and putting on somebody. It's about the cost of keeping the cameras up, cost of the cameras itself. You know, we have a large police force. We don't have a 20 officer force. We have we're in the couple.
Is that your major concern today, the money?
Well, that's potentially one of the costs, but we have to figure out how do we implement this.
Understood.
And put it in. So it's not just simply saying, yes, I'm for it, let's make it happen. It's we have to look at all of the unintended consequences.
We're talking to Mayor Marty Walsh. He's with us once a month for Ask the Mayor. He's taking our questions and yours, and that conversation is going to continue until the top of the hour. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marge Regan, and most importantly, the mayor of the city of Boston, who's kind enough to spend an hour with us and you every month. Mr. Mayor, before we get back to the calls, a number of small business people and the head of the Mass Retailers Association have tweeted virtually the same question. Should Massachusetts join 39 states and pass a teen training wage to cut inner-city teen summer unemployment, essentially a sub-minimum wage for teens? Where are you on that?
I mean, I'm kind of torn on that. I know that was floated before by Dan Winslow when he was a state representative. We had long conversations about it. The issue comes down to some of our teens in Boston actually are working to support a family, and how do you know who's supporting the family and who's actually working for the summer? And it makes it very difficult. And if we cut the minimum wage, and there are kids out there that are going to our schools. I was over at East Boston High School. We have a lot of kids over there that are working, teachers told me, working and helping support the family. So that's where the problem comes into play. It sounds like a great idea, and in theory, it's a wonderful idea. The problem is those teens that are actually helping support their families, so they get caught up the idea is great, but you get caught up in losing wages because of a teen minimum wage. And
so where do you end up? If the legislature had a hearing and they wanted you to testify, what would you say?
Probably would not support it.
We're not supporting it. Okay.
So, and one more thing, Mr. Mayor, you just hired this woman from Goldman Sachs, Sarah Meyerson, yep. Going to be seeing, looking at the bid, transportation planning, everything for the Olympics. Yep. I assume this is to make sure the city is not on the hook for massive amounts of money.
Any amount of money. I mean, this really is. I mean, I think the biggest question, one of the biggest problems with the Olympics to date is people feel that there's going to be public money in the bid. And I think that question needs to be answered. Now, I know the polling isn't good or it's getting a little better, but at the end of the day, whether the polling gets to 50%, 60%, or wherever it gets to, it's only going to go up when people say, I feel confident that my taxpayers' dollars aren't going into venues. I think that if it's going into infrastructure, you need to fix the infrastructure regardless. But I think we have to do a better story of explaining to people that there's no public money going into venues. By saying that, Sarah's job is going to be sitting down with the organizers of 2024 to go over the documents to make sure that they understand and that the USOC understands that as we move forward down this road, we are not investing. The city of Boston, taxpayers of Boston, are not investing in building an event venue, a stadium that's going to be taken down, housing that's going to be built. We're not investing in that.
You know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
There was a story in the Globe yesterday about tenants in, I'm not sure if they were in Roxbury and Dorchester, but they were low-income tenants that are really apparently freaking out, and a lot of their neighbors are, too, with fears that they're going to be displaced because the Olympics, their rent's going to go through the roof.
When aren't these other countries that wipe out neighborhoods to build venues? There's no need here in Boston. We have the places. We have locations that we could build, that we could fix, and every location that we've looked at has not been a place that there's housing. And if any place, let's say we identified a place for housing to build the Olympic Village. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm going to demand that we improve the housing in that area. I mean, I don't think of a place that would happen to, but wherever. I mean, but we're not going to displace people's housing in Boston. I think it might have happened in a couple other cities in the United States, but they didn't have what we have here. I mean, the reason why we can bring the Olympics here is because the places that some of the places we've identified for venues work.
877-301-8970. Go ahead.
A couple other Olympic things that came in. We have asked you ad nauseum, as everybody else has, about how you feel about ballot campaigns. And I think one of the days I was off, you said at minimum there should be a poll, there should be 70% support for going forward. Yep. One of your spokespeople said recently a ballot approach was, quote, the preferred way. Where are you today? Do you support? I mean, the Boston 2024 sports a ballot question. I don't know what ballot question.
People want a ballot question. That's the one thing that I consistently hear across the board. People want a chance to vote on the Olympics.
So do you support that now?
I mean, I support the will of the voter. I mean, if the voter wants it, we have to make sure that it happens.
Charlie Baker was standing where you're standing about a week ago, and we said to him, if the question says what we believe it will say, which is that other than dollars for transportation infrastructure, and by the way, we've seen a draft of the question that Evan Falchuk's group has filed with the Attorney General's office, and it essentially says that other than infrastructure spending, there shall be no state money. We asked Charlie Baker if he would vote for that, and he said yes. Would you?
Absolutely. I haven't read the ballot question, but
if that were the concept, other than transportation infrastructure, no public money. If that's what the ballot question said, obviously you have to be worded legally. Would you vote for that?
That's what we've been saying. That's what I've been saying. I mean, Sarah Meyerson, who's working for the city, we're billing 2024 to pay for her salary. I mean, there's going to be, obviously, as venues start to happen, transportation is going to be involved potentially if upgrading transportation, if there's transportation infrastructure. That's money that the city's going to be putting into to upgrade the infrastructure. But again, I would view that as infrastructure improvements.
So you'd vote for it?
I'd vote for somebody, absolutely.
Larry Lucchino, we talked with Shirley Leung a couple of minutes ago, yep. Business columns, front page of the Globe, Mark Arsenal piece that Lucchino, everybody knows who he is, has met with Boston 2024, I think John Fish, and with you. Are you urging him to take over this operation?
I had a conversation with Larry. I have not met with him yet. But
a conversation.
I certainly think that, you know, Larry has the experience and the understanding of how to deliver something. You know, he's done it several times in around sporting venues. Mm-hmm. I believe he was with, it's in the paper today. I know he's with the Washington Redskins. He was with, worked
Baltimore
them.
Orioles, Bill San Diego Camden, Padres, Yads, yep.
San Diego Padres, the Red Sox. I mean, before John Henry and Tom Warner and these guys came to Boston, if you remember what Fenway was like and what's happened since then and the life livelihood around the park. So he understands how to be a business person. And I gotta think that they don't do it by spending all this money. They do it by watching the bottom line. Having somebody like Larry Lucchino come in potentially, somebody who can watch the bottom line and also understands coming in that, you know, the people don't want to put public money into this. I think that, again, that's the biggest question. I think he'd be a good choice.
Did you ask him to take over?
No.
You hesitated for a split second.
Not on that one. No.
Oh, not on that one? Okay. 877-301. Not on that one, he says. 877-301-8970. Mr. Mayor, back to the Coles.
How about we go to Chris in Jamaica Plain?
Hello, Chris.
Hi, Mayor Walsh. I want to speak to the issue of the Olympics. I'm very, very concerned with your approach on this. I don't really know where to start. I worked for you in the campaign. I said you'd have an open administration, and to throw in, and it really feels like it's you're throwing in with John Fish and these Boston 2024 folks and not allowing for the experts on these issues like Andrew Zimbalist, who spoke last night at UMass Boston. Why aren't you coming to the meetings in the city and hearing directly from us? Because I have a number of questions.
Let me just start. First of all, Andrew Zimbalist, I don't know how. I know that he has his opinion on this, and I think his opinion is more than what he's finding. I don't think he's actually looking at both sides, because he's been rebutted a number of times on TV and in some of the things he's written about questioning some of the numbers he's put out there, and I don't think he's responded to that.
By the way, he's a Smith. For those who don't know, he's a Smith economist who's written a book called Circus Maximus. I'm sorry, Mr. Mayor.
But and I think he's more opposed to the Olympics than he is actually. I think it's more of against the Olympics than anything else, but that's my opinion. But
let him answer, Chris.
I have gone. I mean, we've had in the city of Boston, we've had three of the nine public meetings that we scheduled. And when I say we, Boston, city of Boston scheduled. I've hit two of the three. The third one, which was about a week and a half ago, I couldn't make, and the next one I can't make. But I've made a commitment to get to as many as I can. The Franklin Park meeting, the first one was a 2024 meeting, so I didn't go there because it was a 2024 meeting with the community. And it's something that, I mean, I will go to meetings. I'm certainly accessible. You'll see me out there. I'm out there all over the place, and we can have a conversation about this. I can't go to every single Olympic meeting. You know, I've made this perfectly clear. I think the Olympics, bringing the Olympics or having the conversation Olympics would be a good thing for the city of Boston. But it's not my only focus, and it's not my primary focus. My primary focus is to be mayor of the city of Boston, to make sure that I run the city and we work with the folks in the city to make sure we continue to make this the best city in the world. That's my job as mayor. The Olympics is part of a conversation that we're having. It's not my main focus every day. I don't wake up in the morning talking about the Olympics. I wake up in the morning talking to Commissioner Evans about what happened the night before, and then I go through my day, and the Olympics should not, as mayor, dominate my day.
Chris, thank you for the call. Mr. Mayor, in and around the recent marathon, I know you spent a lot of time with the Richard family, including the little girl Jane, and I know the parents and that sort of thing. You, when you were a legislator, you opposed the death penalty.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Everybody's been talking about the front page piece by the Richard parents saying that they thought life in prison without parole made sense. Flip side, Liz Norden, who's the parent of two young men, both of whom lost a leg, who said they think Tsarnaev should be executed. What do you think should happen? I'm sure you've been following the trial as closely as one can, not being in the courtroom.
I've been watching it closely, and I've made the statement. I will give my personal feeling after the jury makes its decision. I don't feel as a political person right now I should be interjecting mm-hmm. myself in the conversation. I commend and respect all sides on this. I know the Richard family personally. It took tremendous courage to write that. They thought out every word. I've spoken to many of the survivors. I have not gotten into a conversation with them about whether or not they feel that death penalty should be appropriate or not. I think that, you know, they're the ones who should be able to speak and say how they feel about it. I don't think a politician or politics, I don't think we should be talking about it. I think we should let the case take its course, let the jury make the decision, and when it's all over, I'll make my opinion. I've said it in the beginning, I'm not going to grandstand on this issue. From the beginning of the trial, I've said, this is probably the most I've ever said about the trial. I'm just not going to grandstand on this.
Let's go back to the calls, Mr. Mayor.
How about we go to Susan in Rosendale?
Hello, Susan.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Hi, Mr. Mayor.
Hi, Susan.
My question is this. I've been reading in the Globe, now correct me if I'm wrong, that the Long Island Bridge is going to cost over $100 million when everything is all said and done, and yet MassDOT is saying that they refuse to replace the Casey Overpass Bridge because it's going to cost $70 million. However, about 120,000 people use the Casey Overpass Bridge every day, and very limited amount of people use the Long Island Bridge. I think maybe like, 20 people a day? And it's limited access to get to the Long Island Bridge. There's guards there. And it makes no sense to me. Can you, clear this up?
Yeah, let me clear it up for you.
Understand why that's happening?
Let me just, first of all, the Casey Overpass is a state road. Long Island Bridge is a city road. Just so you'll know, so I in the city, have very little say in the Casey Overpass coming down. All these conversations happened prior to me becoming mayor of the city of Boston. When I was a candidate for mayor, and all of us, it was an issue in the campaign. But the problem is that we have very little control over it because it was pretty much a done deal. By the time I became mayor of the city of Boston, the bridge had already gone out to bid to take it down and move forward. The Long Island Bridge is, I've been quoted in the past as saying that I plan on rebuilding the Long Island Bridge, but we're talking about years down the road. We're not sure what the cost will be. Right now, we've taken the bridge down. I believe it's almost all down. We imploded a section of it yesterday because it was literally collapsing into the ocean. We're doing an architectural study of the bridge now to see what a new bridge would look like and how much it would cost. And then, quite honestly, we have to figure out, if we build it, how we pay for it. Estimates go for anywhere from $80 to $100 million. Right now in the city of Boston with the budget and our capital budget, we have priorities like building schools. We have priorities like building new firehouses, new police stations, upgrading our facilities. So $100 million would be a big chunk out of our capital budget. So I haven't gone to the next step as far as I want to see what would look like, how much the cost would be before I make any decisions on how we move forward on it. We are building out the Southampton Street homeless facility for long term. We're putting in showers, and I mentioned some today. We're putting in new facilities in there. We're putting in rooms in there so people can be counseled and clinical. People can be in there talking to people. We're looking at delivering services to homeless people in Boston in a lot different manner. In the past, for the most part, we've just housed homeless people, which means they come in at night, get a meal, get a shower, go out in the morning. We have a task force that's working right now. How do we deliver services better? And what I mean by that is, how do we begin to end homelessness in the city of Boston? We have some people that are homeless that are down on their luck. We simply need to, not simply, but get them into job training programs and help them back on their feet. We have folks with mental health issues. We have to figure out, how do we handle the mental health issues? We have folks with drug and alcohol problems. Is there an opportunity for us to counsel them back into a positive manner for themselves, positive state of mind, so we can help them off homelessness? So there's a lot of work we can do. And I'm hoping that when I'm done as mayor, whenever that is, or in the next few years, our numbers, instead of increasing, go down.
Susan, thank you for the call. Our number is 877-301-8970. The mayor will be here till 1 o'clock.
You know, I haven't been able to read all the emails, and there are a lot of them, but we're going to send them on to the mayor's office. But here's one from Pam in Rosendale, Mr. Mayor, who says, our gas was turned off on Wednesday because the landlord owes the gas company $3,900. When this happened 2 years ago, we were without hot water and for 2 weeks, filed a complaint with inspectional services. No one is coming to inspect until next Friday. I had to go outside to shower or someplace else to shower this morning, and a downstairs neighbor can't cook because they have a gas stove. The landlord has said, there are always other options. In other words, move. So she wants to know why landlords aren't penalized for this kind of behavior and why does it take so long to get these things resolved. No access to hot water is a health issue. Boy, Pam, I feel sorry for your situation over there.
No, absolutely. And that's something that when you read that, was that 2 years ago the water was shut off? Is now?
2 weeks.
Two weeks ago.
Okay. Well, first of all, Pam, I'm going to take your information, and somebody from Inspection Services is not.
2 years ago. I'm sorry. Oh, 2 years ago.
All right.
Well,
all right.
I'm sorry. My apologies.
I thought it was next Friday. I said they'll be out there in about an hour. But it's something that's not supposed to happen. We're working with when we did the rental housing inspection ordinance. We were really increasing some of our folks to go out and do inspection of housing. There's no excuse for that, and there's no call for that. And when I go back, I'll talk to Inspection Services. There's a new commissioner there now. We have a new system over there, a new setup. So let me find out what the repercussions are. But there's no excuse for that. Tenants should not go without hot water or heat in their apartments. And it's the heat's the law. I know that. So let me look into that.
You know, Pam, you tweeted us. So if you tweet us your phone number or an email address, we will pass that along to the mayor's office. Speaking of tweets, we have zillions of them. So let's go through a few before we get back to the calls at 877-301-8970. Cotton Southie, a terrific blog, I should say, asks, how about one ways in Southie? There's a big meeting about it next week to discuss keeping them permanent. Yeah. Talk about controversial. How about it, Mr. Mayor?
Well, I'll tell you, when we did it, it wasn't controversial.
That's true.
It was uniformly, everyone loved it. And then I heard throughout the winter, keep it, keep it, keep it. And then over the last couple of weeks, I'm hearing, you know, this is terrible. I have to drive, you know, 5 blocks to get to my street. And there's a segment of South Boston that live on the numbered streets that the one ways are on, and they love it because traffic has slowed down. I mean, traffic has reduced on their street. However, there's been some issues of people speeding because it's one ways now. We have a public meeting in Southie next week. We have two public meetings coming over the course of the next couple of weeks. We also are going to be putting out a survey out to all the residents that live on those streets. We're actually putting it together now. A survey will be sent to everyone's house where people will be able to respond whether or not they want to keep the one-ways. We're going to look at the surveys and make a decision. The one-ways are in effect until June 1st. And then after that, if we don't get a good feel for it, when I say a good feel, if it's 50-50, we'll probably won't keep the one-ways. If there's a majority of people that want the one-ways, we'll probably keep them. If there's a majority of people that don't want the one-ways, we won't keep them. But, you know, it's a mixed feeling on it now, but it did work during the wintertime. It allowed us to be able to get out there and clean the streets and have less confusion. And like I said, some streets love it too, by the way, now, and some streets don't.
It's easier to triple park on one-way streets.
It certainly is, and I think people know that. And you know, but there's some issues around buses. Buses used to go up different streets, and now they moved further away. So there's some work that has to be done there, but we're going to do an assessment. I think the community meeting is going to be important, and I would ask people to come to it. We don't have to get emotional. Just express your conversation about how you want it. I mean, people tend to, in any meeting in the city of Boston, to get very emotional about issues. And you can get emotional, but just let's have a conversation, because at the end of the day, it's going to be what the majority of the people want.
How long do you feel like you've been doing this job?
I've been in it for 16 months.
No, I know how long it's been. How long does it feel?
I feel like I've been here for 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
You know,
it's great. I love it.
How hard is this? I mean, it's hard. It's really hard.
It changes every day. And the way I express it, you know, when I was a legislator before this, and I loved it, and it was fun.
But you can hide out as a legislator, can't you?
We could contemplate on issues.
Yes.
And now, you know, this is something that, you know, we ask the question, we expect an answer. Something happens today, 10 minutes later, people expect my opinion. You asked me about, you know, the governor's legislation, where I actually would have to take a deeper look at that to talk about it, you know. But It's fun. I mean, you can do great things. Yesterday, we had a group of kids in the office, young people in the office that we were kind of mentoring, and not kind of. They were in there to hear people's stories. So I went in and talked about my life story to the kids. They were high school kids. And then they had a chance to go with the commissioner of transportation, the fire commissioner, and really go around and meet people. And that stuff is great. I mean, and the summer's coming now, and the good weather's coming. It's great to be out in the street talking to people and seeing people, because generally people, you know, are very happy with what's happening. But it's great to see people, and I love that part of the job.
A couple of people, actually more than a couple of people, have tweeted about the casino in Everett and want an update. And the most recent one, Jonathan, also mentioned Joan Vernocchi's column yesterday. I don't know if you saw it, about Steve Wynn making a $2 million contribution to the Republican Governors Association. The next day, coincidence or not, $1.1 million goes to the committee supporting Charlie Baker for governor. And the question he asks is, if Baker okays the T's land sale to Wynn, this MBTA land piece, will you consider going to court to block the Everett Casino? What is the status of your discussions? What's going on?
We're in court now. The city of Boston's in court right now. And we're still claiming that, you know, we're a host community. We're going through the court process. And, you know, the MBTA land sale there changes the way the building is shaped and kind of takes the city of Boston out of the equation in some ways. You know, I think the governor has to make a decision based on the facts that he has in front of him and what's happened. And,
have you spoken to him about it?
We've had brief conversations about it, but this all started prior to Governor Baker being in office. This we called out this deal. I called this deal out last year and said that there's a problem with this deal. With the T-land. Yeah. I felt that if it's going to be sold, it should go out to open bid and let fair market value and let somebody open a full open bid. I mean, there's many developers that would love to buy that land. It's in a great location. And if we had a development there, a private developer there, not necessarily a casino, but people willing to sit down with us and talk to us about the traffic at Sullivan Square, well, they'd want to see the traffic fixed as well. So we're in the court process now. My hands are tied a little bit with where we go. So we really have no new update right now.
Do you think there's a backroom deal made that allowed this originally to go to Wynn as it did?
I don't know.
Okay. Let's go back to the calls, Mr. Mayor.
How about we go with Roy and Taunton?
Hello, Roy.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's a great show. And I wanted to ask the mayor if he had ever considered, since the facility in Long Island appears to be in good shape, the only problem there was the bridge. And I remember driving over it several times. It was a scary experience. Have you ever considered using, as a temporary means of getting there, a shuttle boat or a ferry boat to go back and forth? I think back to when I was down in Curacao. Curacao has a bridge that goes across the harbor, and whenever the bridge is open, they then employ the use of ferry boats to bring people back and forth. Have you ever thought about doing that, Mr. Mayor?
Thanks, Roy.
Yeah, thanks for that. Was one of the first things I thought about when the bridge had to be closed, and you know, a lot of the programs on the island trying to logistically get homeless folks 300, 400, 500 a night on and off the island through ferry seems like it would work. The problem was going to be the medical facilities, and if somebody needed a medical facility immediately, we couldn't get ambulances out there, and it'd be difficult in some cases to get people off the island. Also, the detox programs and the holdings out there, that's where the problem comes in. I will tell you this, that Camp Harborview, Jack Connors and Camp Harborview right now is raising money to actually have ferry service for the camp this summer. So there will be service.
It's for inner city kids,
inner
by
city
the way.
Kids,
I got
yeah.
to spend a few weeks, many of whom, by the way, I've been out there with your predecessor, many of whom live a mile away from the harbor and have never seen the harbor before.
So there is going to be a ferry service that's going to be taking the kids out there, and it's going to be interesting to see how that works in the summertime logistically. So there might be an opportunity for us to maybe open some other programming on the island once we see how it works in the summertime. But Camp Harborview is going to have ferry service this year on the island.
Great. Roy, thank you for your call.
You know, Mr. Mayor, on the anniversary of the marathon, you urged people to do this random act of kindness thing.
Yeah.
I thought
we
was
talked about
neat.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. But you were keeping under wraps your act of kindness. Are you ready to?
No, it was a great day. I mean, it was, you know, I spent a lot of the day in the morning with the families and survivors of that terrible day.
Yeah.
And we had a little breakfast at the Copy Library, very low key with a lot of survivors. I mean, they're incredible people. I got to meet them all and know them pretty well at the end of last year, the first anniversary. And when everyone saw each other, everyone was hugging, how you doing, what's going on? And it was inspirational. And then after that, I had a chance to go We went to Spalding Rehab. We went to a blood drive at the Sheraton Hotel. Went to Firehouse on Boylston Street, police station in the south end, the station that actually responded there, that a lot of the officers were there. And we went back and thanked them for their service. And later that day, we had a moment of silence. And then I did some other things that night. But it was just a great day. And I'll tell you, the people of Boston and all over Massachusetts, actually on Twitter, we were trending. One Boston Day was trending where the president tweeted something out, vice president retweeted, and people, it was trending in the sense around the world. So it was really, really incredible day to remember a terrible act of violence and turning into something that's going to be positive from here on out in a positive way. So it was a nice day and, you know, very emotional day. I had a lot of different emotional scenes in my head.
When you're sitting with, as you say, you've gotten to know them well, victims, survivors, are there moments where you just don't know what to say?
Yeah, I mean, right, this week. I mean, this week is one of those moments during the trial when you see somebody, you just want to offer support and, you know, you don't want to get into a conversation. I know that if I was on a job site, we could talk about, you know, let's get this guy and do this to him. but when you're talking to the survivors and families, you know, you got to remember they're personally affected by what happened that day. And it's difficult. And I think you just want to, I offer a word of support and I'm there for you. You know, I've randomly called some of the people over the last couple of weeks just to check in, see how you're doing. And they love hearing from when I call them. They're just excited that we called. And I think it's, you just got to be there for them. And I just suggest to anyone that knows somebody who was affected that day, just be there for them. You know, you don't have to give your opinion. Just be there for them. And I think that sometimes they just need to vent. And they don't have a lot of place they can vent because when they vent, it's public. So I just listen to them because, you know, everything anyone says is, well, so-and-so was at the marathon and this is how they feel about something. And so I think just listen to them and be there for them to talk to, yell at, cry on, whatever the emotions are.
One last marathon-related question. Did you contemplate, the rumors around town, you contemplated doing the exact same thing at the finish line that your chief of staff did. is there any truth to that, Mr. Mayor?
No, you can't, you know, Dan and Amy had the...
He proposed to her, for those who don't know. Yes,
Dan and Amy had the spotlight that day, and that's their spotlight.
Okay, what's the answer to my question?
I just told you, it's their day.
We think his act of kindness might involve his significant other, though. That's what I suspect, even though he doesn't want to say so.
By the way, everybody who's online, everybody who sent an email, as always, if you hold on, we'll take your phone number, we'll give it to the mayor's office. If you email, we'll forward it to the mayor's office. Everything will be responded. Mr. Mayor, it's a pleasure to see you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much for coming
month.
In. That's the voice of Mayor Marty Walsh, who joins us every month for Ask the Mayor. Thank you again, Mr. Mayor. Coming up, time for her rundown of her weird obsessions and observations. That's Emily Rooney joining us for Open Mic with her famous listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is our colleague. You know her as the Commissioner of Common Sense. We know her as Emily Rooney. She is here with her list of preoccupations and pet peeves, or whatever they are. Emily,
they're not that weird today, Marjorie.
Pardon me, Madam Commissioner, is very good to see you. Thank you so much.
So, Emily, I have heard you and Philip Martin, our reporter, giving updates all week long.
And Adam.
Adam Riley, that's right. I'm sorry. Yesterday was an incredible day in the courthouse.
All 3 days, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I put it as, it was like a punctuation point to the first phase of the trial, which was, of course, the guilt phase. And within 3 days, they kind of recreated that, but in a very, very poignant way. They didn't really need to do any of this. But it was much more emotional than the first part of the trial because they wanted to show, frankly, pain and suffering, which we got in just droves over the past 3 days. And that was the point they were trying to drive home in order to establish that Jahar Tsarnaev deserves the death penalty.
Well, you know, I think that is a crucial thing because you see, for example, Mrs. Corcoran, who got out of her car,
yes.
She lost both legs. And you see her and you say, well, look at her. She's on these prosthetic
yeah.
legs and she's a pretty woman and she looks great. And there she is with her husband. But this is like endless
and, you know,
visits to the doctors and re-surgeries.
She said something, Marjorie, that I just stabbed at my heart. And I thought I would be the same way. She said, not a second goes by that I don't think about the fact that I'm a double amputee. It's like, oh.
Yeah, I mean, this is a...
How about this one? You know, that Adriana Haslett Davis. She said, we were on Boylston Street. We were just so in love. She said, I was wearing platform shoes because I wanted to look cute for my husband. At the end of her testimony, which was so riveting,
The prosecutor said to her, "Your husband isn't here today, is he?" She said, "No, he isn't." She said, "Why not?" "Because yesterday he checked himself into a mental health facility. He's got tinnitus, you know what that is? Which is, it literally drives you crazy. I mean, I don't think it's just
one
that.
One of our colleagues did a great report on that.
Yes, it's really, I mean, and he had that other guy, Eric Wally, who lost the eye, he has that also. I mean, he said it drives him crazy.
And tell us about the gentleman with the little three-year-old. And
that was Stephen Wolfenden. Yeah, Steve Wolfenden.
As I said that, I never even heard of him before
I think he
turned
down interview.
None of us
request.
Had heard of Steve Wolfenden or Eric Wally. And I think part of why their testimony was so riveting, because they were strangers. We've gotten very familiar with Heather Abbott, which is great. I mean, they wanted to be out there and talk, and we connected with them, Celeste Corcoran, among others. But these two people had really, really personal stories to tell. Steve Wolfenden had the three-year-old little boy, Leo, with him. Leo was blown out of his arms, and he looked and he saw that the kid was injured, and all he cared about was trying to get help for. And then he realized he couldn't do anything because his own leg had been blown off. I mean, he was so understated. They all have been.
And he was right next to Denise Richard,
and
was he not?
Denise Richard is. He talks about how he could see that Martin's eyes had rolled back into his head, and he appeared to be dying. And he was the one who kept saying, and she kept saying, "Please, Martin, please, Martin, please, Martin." And just when she finished doing that, she turned back and looked at him and said, "Are you okay?"
And what did this man say who just lost his leg?
He said, "I'm okay." He didn't realize how badly he had been lost, been hurt.
You know, a lot of this testimony didn't come from the family, but had some connection to, obviously, the person who's become the symbol of the horror, little 8-year-old Martin Richard. I was surprised, I think, that neither parent, Denise or Bill, testified in this phase. Now, obviously, the father did in the penalty, in the guilt phase. What should we make of that, if anything?
We were told a little bit, but I can't say too much because it was off the record.
Okay.
We were briefed about it. But my guess is, I mean, I don't know this for a fact. My guess is that they might have been asked and didn't want to. I don't know. Because for the most part, with the exception of one witness, everybody was new. Even all of the victims were new. So I think if they were going to have anybody testify, it would have been Denise. But my guess is, I don't know, but for
sure, you know,
that she didn't
want to. I don't know either, but it would certainly make sense that they would feel after their emotional and beautiful letter they wrote about their wanting the suffering to end and not for this death penalty. It would make sense that they might say, you know, we've been through enough.
I know, but they, you know, supposedly the jury didn't see that, you know.
Well, the flip side might be, and this is no more speculation than yours, it's possible also the prosecution
didn't want them. It's possible.
Because even though they talked a lot about the death of their little boy, the assumption that I make, even though they would be violating the court rules, is they all, or most of them, know about the Richard piece on the front page of the newspaper, and that sort of reinforces it. Even though, and we raised this issue a lot last week, nobody was asked, nor did they comment on what their preference was.
They were not,
in terms of outcome.
I don't think you were allowed to ask them. Yeah, so that didn't happen.
So in Monday, the defense finally
gets to
do something. Apparently, some of the relatives of Sarnaya were in
town. Yeah, I was just looking at all that video from last night and this morning. Not the parents. The parents are not here, and I don't recognize or identify any of the people. Clearly, some of them are Russian, and they look Russian. They're dressed in Russian garb, staying over at a hotel in Revere under very tight security, I should say. U.S. Marshals and the Federal Defender's Office are there. And they will either be there to testify for the defense, or they will be there to offer support for Jahar Zarnaev.
But we have no idea who they're calling as of this moment, the defense. No idea.
We may not even be told. Usually we're briefed off the record at, you know, 8:30 in the morning who's going to appear for the prosecution. But we've been asked if we can get that kind of a briefing. And we haven't even been told whether we would get that kind of a briefing. So
you know, one of the little weird sidelights in the story is, of course, Sarnaya's mother, Zohar Sarnaya's mother, has pending charges against her for shoplifting. So you wonder if she'd returned, would they have?
I think they would have nabbed her instantly.
For the shoplifting?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, for more reasons than one, I think they would have grabbed her. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So are we moving on now? I think
we're
moving on. So what do you think about Larry Lucchino, the Red Sox big deal?
I have to think
now,
it's
brilliant.
His involvement with the Olympics.
Shirley Leung, who was here, thought it was a great idea. Marjorie Egan thought he's just one of the one percenters, yet another
guy. But Marjorie, he has such an approach and such a soothing manner.
I agree with you.
He's a great guy.
He turned the Red Sox around.
He did.
You know, he turned attitude about, even at the same time raising the prices astronomically, he turned attitude around.
He knows how to talk
around.
To angry people, too.
He brought women into the Red Sox. He brought children, little girls. I mean, the pink hat. I mean, he and, you know, Charles Stein, what's his last name?
Steinbrenner?
Steinberg.
Steinberg.
Who does events and public stuff for the Red Sox.
I mean, they should get him on board with this, too.
Well, I'm assuming it might be a package. One doesn't. I mean, we asked Marty Walsh specifically, did he pop the question? Did he say on the phone to Lucchino, I want you to run this? He said no.
Yeah.
But it's pretty clear to me, based upon the mess they've been in, that having him as a public face, even though Marjorie disagrees, I think it changes. I'm not saying everybody's going to support it. You know, like, all of a sudden drop dead in front of Larry Lucchino, I think it changes the equation to a big degree.
I think this is no reflection on Larry Lucchino. Either is my remarks about John Fish owning a construction company a reflection on John Fish. I mean, they're both terrific guys, and Larry Lucchino, I mean, I've told this story before, but I'll tell it again. I remember being at a Red Sox game when Mike Barnicle actually gave me tickets, and he's got these unbelievable tickets, and all of a sudden this couple and their little five-year-old kid shows up in these great seats right next to us, and we were all ordering from the waitress and stuff, and the guy's going on and on. I said, how'd you get these tickets, you know, knowing these weren't his tickets. He said, well, I'm up in the back, and Larry Lucchino walks through, and we're up there in the, you know, right in the, you know, the nosebleed seats. And he says, hi, how you doing? Is this your little boy? Yeah, it's our first time at the Red Sox, first time at Fenway. And Larry Lucchino says, take my tickets.
Aww.
And so this guy and his little five-year-old boy, whose eyes are as big as the moon, is down there in the
those
front.
I know where those seats are.
And Lucchino just, you know, I mean, no fanfare, no nothing.
So here's my question. Would he step aside from the Red Sox? Because that could be a potential conflict of interest.
Well, you have to remember, this comes on the heels of what Red Sox leadership like John Henry denied.
Yeah.
That there is a power struggle. Yeah. A power struggle between.
That's true,
Is his name Mike Gordon? I can't remember. There's another one of the minority owners. There was a piece in the Globe a while ago. Well, I don't know who the guy is. But whatever it was, they denied it. They said, Larry's Larry. Yeah. He's still running this operation. But I'm assuming, for a whole variety of reasons, not just potential conflicts, but the fact that this is more
big job.
A full-time job. Yeah. That if he were to do it, even though the Globe doesn't say that he will, that this would become his primary
occupation. But would he sell
his
interest? Would he just put it on hold?
He hasn't spoken
put it
to
in
me
a blind
about
trust.
It much lately,
I'll take care of it for him.
In any case, I knew you would. But that could, I would argue that that has a potentially far more positive impact than having David Ortiz, as much as we love him.
What did you think of that?
What I thought is, even
David
though
David Ortiz, Larry Bird,
is two things. One, the Ortiz and the Bird and the JoJo White thing. I say, well, even though they don't live here and they're zillionaires, it's still they're beloved. But then when you read down the list. Once again, I think showing tinier-itis. It's the head of an investment company, the head of a this, the head of a that.
Prominent.
Where are the real people? Yeah. And there may be one or two
in
there I never heard of.
Where are the people that are the real Olympic experts? That's what I keep wondering. The people that, you know, have been intimately involved in Olympics elsewhere and know how to do it.
You mean as opposed to just participants? Because there are a few participants on that list.
Michelle Kwan didn't run the Olympics.
Right, exactly.
I mean, are there people that aren't unaware of that are experts?
Over the years, so there are some around here.
No, I mean Olympic experts.
I know what you mean.
She means part of Boston 2024, and the answer is who?
No, there isn't anybody on the team right now, but there are people around that would fit that.
Well, don't you think? I mean, if you're trying to figure out
how
to run the
Olympics.
I don't
know who else is in that office. They must have other people.
Well, it would seem to me if they have Olympic experts, I mean, it's sort of like a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. You say to yourself, why don't they tell us?
I ran into Rich Davey because the office is right next to the Tsarnaev trial, the federal building.
Yeah.
And he said, come on up for a tour.
He's the CEO, by the way, Boston 2024.
I'm going to go up next week and get a tour of the office and, you know, spec it out myself.
Will you do me a favor when you get that tour? Can you ask him when he's showing up on our show? Can you do that?
But here's the difficulty. I mean, Rich Davey is a great guy. Yeah. I love him. He's been in here a million times, but he's got a problem now because the falling apart tea gets blamed at least partially on him because he was there. And he was the
Secretary of Transportation
as well. I think we need a few experts.
Get
right on that, please, Emily.
Okay, so let's play a little haunting trailer for you. Everybody, I assume, has seen this or heard. This is a trailer, and not seeing it is not quite as good in this case as hearing it, but hearing it's pretty good. Here's Johnny Depp as Whitey Bulger talking to former FBI Director John Morris, played by David Harbour. In this scene, Morris disclosed a family steak recipe secret to Bulger, which makes Bulger furious.
I was just saying that.
You were just saying. Just saying gets people sent away.
Just saying. Got me a 9-year stretch in Alcatraz, you understand? So, just saying. Could get you buried real quick.
I gotta say.
Look at his face.
By the way, the notion behind that, before you comment, is he says, I'm going to tell you a family secret. And when he does, Bulger feigns fury by saying, if you'd tell a family secret, then you'd tell a secret about me. You didn't like that very much, did you?
I thought there was a cartoon quality.
There was a cartoon quality to it.
I hope the movie is better than that. And that hokey music and everything. I don't know. Well, I did think in that little scene,
it was pretty
though,
scary.
He really conveyed the rage in
Johnny
Whitey
Depp
Bulger.
Did.
Yes,
I agree with that.
Which I thought was pretty effective. Mm.
But it was cartoon. It was both. In my view, it was cartoon-like, but at the same... And you have to keep in mind, the primary audience are not those of us who live with this. The primary audience is the vast majority of America who only knows little...
And
well, you
know
think
what
people
else?
Aren't going to go to see this?
I don't know. What's the name of the movie again?
Black Mass.
Yeah. You know what else? He didn't have one of those ridiculous Boston accents.
No, he tried a little bit, but it wasn't.
No, it wasn't.
Terrible.
I mean, some of these things, The Mystic River, which is a wonderful movie, we all watched that. But I mean, you listen to the accents in that movie, it was just.
Well, even The Departed,
painful.
All those. It was
horrible. Horrible, yeah. There are very few people with Boston accents.
Did you see Obama tried to do it yesterday?
Oh, no.
With the joke about Butler, about Malcolm Butler.
Oh, I didn't hear the joke about
Butler. You're going to be a toast of every bar. And it was
I hate
a terrible
that. I
accent.
Always say that.
But I mean, really, how often do you hear a Boston accent in Boston? Not that often.
It's the North Shore. See, people think it's Boston. It's actually the North Shore.
Well, it's also South Boston. I hear a few South Boston accents.
It's largely Eddie Murphy territory.
Okay. So we were trying to see if Whitey would do a list, but we can't get Whitey's list. So what we're left with is this.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
Let me tell you, if you don't know Emily Rooney walks into the studio. Marty Walsh is leaving the studio. Relatively busy guy. Yeah. And she says to him, if I were you, I'd stick around a few minutes.
This is my list.
Because a piece of this is about you.
It's just coincidental.
Okay.
Okay, hold on for a second.
Oh, you're going to ask.
Emily?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Do you have a theme?
Kind of.
Okay, kind of.
Good job,
Marjorie. It's all under one umbrella. But
okay,
she's going rogue today.
So these are things that kind of that give me satisfaction and have given me satisfaction recently. You know,
okay.
So one of them, Mayor Marty Walsh, if you're listening, was calling City Hall and getting a positive response. I got one negative and one positive. I mean,
really?
Nothing helped with the snow. And I think I got my notice, two weeks ago that the problem had been resolved, even though it was never. They never plowed Marlborough Street. They just couldn't. That was a hopeless situation. I want to be on that committee next year about parking rules and everything. Anyway, but I did call City Hall earlier before the snow started and got a hugely positive response about the lip of the alley. Somebody had rebuilt it and it was an 18-inch drop. It didn't work at all. I said, you got to rebuild this before I know it. They've rebuilt the lip.
It was
very satisfying.
A lip?
He should have stuck around, you know what I mean?
It was it was an 18-inch drop, so your car hit the bottom of
Okay, I got you.
So
all right.
That
didn't
work.
Great.
All right, you guys both appreciate this.
We will.
This is
something
that gives you satisfaction, getting quoted in the paper.
Ugh.
I don't know why.
What were you quoted about?
Whenever. Marjorie, you said you love it when you called me.
I love calling Emily.
I always
get
a
pithy
quote.
Because she doesn't speak off the record.
Well, and she'd always say these things that were really outrageous. And I think, wow, I can't believe Emily Rooney just said that. And here I go, type it right up.
But it's so funny. It's like you can do an interview for television. You can do this. It's just nothing like seeing your little quote there in the paper.
Absolutely. That is, I love that. I really love that.
By the way, do you
Google yourself? Do you have Google
Occasionally.
Alert? No, you don't Google Alert.
You know, my brother-in-law sends me my own Google Alert.
You were kidding me.
You know, I don't have that.
Do you do Google Alert
yourself?
Jim
has several Google Alerts.
That's
hilarious. You don't Google? You have Google Alerts so you get stuff where your name comes up?
I know.
I'm up like 24
hours waiting. Here's something that's
I gotta check it right now.
Here's something that's even more satisfying than getting quoted in the paper.
What?
Getting a letter to the editor published.
That's pretty good, too.
I've gotten a few of those.
Oh, I've never even done it.
Oh,
well, because you were...
A newspaper
person. You couldn't do it.
Yeah, I couldn't do it.
Yeah, that is
okay.
Pretty
hold on for a second. What did you write a letter to the editor about?
Oh, this was this stupid thing about. It was about Columbus Day traffic and about how somebody was complaining. And I said, no. it's like this every year. And I explained why. Because it's always like that because it's a three-day weekend, the last day for the summer vacationers. Right. And it's leaf peeping. It has nothing to do with traffic patterns or the tolls or so. Anyway, it was just a sensible.
And where they published
it? I can't remember. It was Globe or something. I don't know.
Good
Globe.
For you. That's very anyway, impressive.
Let's see. Satisfaction. Winning a game. I don't care what it is. Any kind of a game, a prize, even if you don't want it. You know, just like for a few days, it just kind of stays
yeah,
with you.
Winning.
You're relatively Edgar, competitive. Do you not think
oh,
so?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Edgar just won this
the Merrill Award.
Murrow. That's wonderful. It's such
Edgar
a good
B. Hirsch
feeling.
III, yeah.
Good for him. For what?
For that piece he did on
bus stops. And
no, it's about when a bus goes by
right.
And it says out of service, and you're standing there going, what?
That was great. It was
that's
great.
That's right.
I know. Yeah.
That was a great one. He's so talented.
All right.
I won Most Improved Camper. Do you know that? Oh. Camp Bonneville. What do you mean? No.
That's good.
What
anything,
is good?
Anything like that.
I did.
It's great. All
thank
right.
you. She's mocking me.
Satisfying.
I want a pair of water skis on the Channel 2 auction.
Okay, fine.
Trick skis.
Being right about a rule. So the other day I'm playing tennis and I serve something and I say, oh, that was a let. And the three other people say, you can't call that. I said, yeah, I can call it. Anybody can call a let. Oh, no, I can't call it. I said, all right, fine, I can't call it. So I run to the USTA rules and of course you can call. Anybody can call a let. All right, here's one, Jim.
Yikes.
I got this notice in the mail the other day, vehicle alert notice with my VIN number and everything else, important information.
That's a problem.
Final notice.
Final.
Your factory warranty.
She brought it. She's
something,
holding up the exhibit.
I smelled a rat when
you
I
did?
Got this, even though I had my VIN and the day I bought the exactly what my car is.
Yeah.
So I just said, you know what? I think this is bogus. Sure enough, I call Audi. Because rather than call the number that they give you, and this is apparently a scam going around, folks, that they're getting you to buy additional stuff that has nothing to do with the dealer who sold you the car. So beware. Vehicle alert notice.
That how
progress,
satisfying
but
is that?
By
very the way,
satisfying.
You're probably the kind of person, unlike Marjorie, when you get that email from the Nigerian prince, you know right away.
I respond. Oh, I respond. I know I do. You should see
and
some of the things
say?
I've said.
Oh, my God.
Really?
You call me. Here's my number.
Yeah, for you.
Oh, absolutely. I always respond to those people.
It's beautiful.
All right. So here's some figuring out how to put something together. It doesn't matter how simple. It's something with a bike rack or a tape dispenser, which I just figured out this tape dispenser. I was so proud of myself. One of those giant tape dispensers that you use for moving with nobody else's help. You know, don't you usually have to hand it? I can't do this.
We did a whole show yesterday on how, not a whole show, a section of a show, about how if people put together something from IKEA, they will drag it from apartment to apartment to apartment. They're so proud.
Being able to do it yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't even know that. That's a good one. All right, here's one that this just happened to me this week. Figuring out how to bypass the recordings and getting a live person on the phone. Just hitting the right, you got to keep hitting the right numbers.
No. But there's something, you don't even know about this?
There's
a website either called
numbers.
gethuman.com something, which tells you for virtually every major business
so
in
like
America,
Bank of America
how to circumvent the
voice.
Yeah,
I figured it out on my own. You're calling Bank of America.
Very
all right,
okay,
finally.
Finally.
Finding, this is satisfaction, finding what you think is the perfect parking spot, which happened to me yesterday at the courthouse.
Oh,
nothing
love
better.
That.
However, I came out because I was leaving a little bit early, just as they were writing me this giant ticket. So it was even more satisfactory that I got them to tear the ticket up.
They can't tear the ticket up. They had started doing
it? Yeah, they just started.
It must be because did you tell them who you were?
No.
Wow, that is pretty good.
Were you illegally parked?
You know, I still don't understand. Because when I drove up, the guy waved me and said, park there. But I think it had a limit on it or something like that. I don't know.
Can't be there for 8 hours.
Very satisfying. It got perfect parking and no ticket.
Boy, it doesn't get much better than
that.
Okay, fine. What are you doing tonight on Beat the Press?
Okay, my list. I got to have all my lists here today.
What's going on?
Beat the Press. Oh, so I don't know how I feel about this, but you know the hovering that the news media is doing over the Tsarnaev family with the helicopters and chasing the white vans like it's the Bronco.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, these people, they're relatives. They're not criminals. And the relatives of a criminal, but
and
then
he had that uncle. Remember the uncle that called them losers?
Yes,
was that Baltimore?
Yes,
I forget where he was from.
Yeah.
So I have no idea if he's among them.
I don't know.
He was
these
not
people
exactly
definitely
on their
some
side.
Of these people came in from Russia.
Okay,
but I don't know. We're going to be looking at that.
That's
then
actually a good one.
I'm going to look at the whole finger dust up and whether you should have been blurring the photo or not blurring the photo and blurring the real.
Can
photo
I respond
and not
to that right
the
now? We did on Greater Boston, and can I tell you something? I'm embarrassed that we did.
I berated your producers.
I didn't know that, by the way.
I did.
I have to say, I thought about it last night.
I couldn't believe you went along with that.
I was really embarrassed that we
anyway,
did.
Anyway.
Every year and a half, Jim makes a mistake.
NBC did not blur it.
I made a big
mistake. But beyond blurring the finger, whether the prosecution oversold that whole episode to the media, and some people like David Boyeri from BOR thinks we really did.
How can they? How can they not? I mean, they obviously considered it was so huge to put it in their opening statement there.
Yeah,
go ahead. What else?
Hillary denying access to the media. We're going to some people are calling for boycotts of her events just because she doesn't allow the media to ask any questions.
Of whom? Of her?
Of her. Yeah.
Okay.
Did you see the video? I think we played this on Greater Boston. I'm confusing myself. Of her with this thing where not... Oh, Adam did this package,
yes.
Actually. Adam Riley. Not only could the media not ask questions, the people who came to her faux little listening thing couldn't ask questions. She asked them questions.
Exactly.
So what do you do?
Yeah,
what do you think
exactly.
about education
no, it's,
policy?
It's,
by the way, you know, that's how I feel about Bill Belichick's things, by the way.
I know.
The media should stand up and say, if you're not going to treat us
never
respectfully, then we're not going to go to your stuff.
She's going to have a tough time.
Something's going to happen.
There's so much animus toward her, even from people that like her, and the campaign's barely begun.
Yeah.
See your numbers in New Hampshire? There may be animus in the media, and there may be nervousness, but we talked to John King about this today. Democrats, apparently, they may not love her, but they sure as hell are behind her.
Does he think that book about the foundation, all that's going to hurt
her? He thinks that he... what did he say? That's how we started today.
The issue is not Democrats. I think the issue is the people in the middle that are centrist.
What his answer to that question was, I think, is first of all, the author is a conservative, leaning person. The New York Times did its own investigation, obviously, and did that. And I think what he said to Marjorie's question was, if it was just rehashing of old stuff, I think the public, he said, you know, if it was Lewinsky or it was Whitewater or something, they'd say, we've done that already. But this thing, I think he said to us a couple of hours ago, has a little bit more of a shelf life. And I tend to agree with him, by the way. And by the way, what he did say is if someone like Martin O'Malley decided to get involved in this race and a Democrat raised the issue as opposed to Republicans whose living is crashing her, it might be taken on a life of its own. In any case, we'll see you tonight.
See you guys later.
That was another great list.
Stellar.
Bye. Stellar. They're always stellar. Emily joins us every Friday for that stellar list. Brilliant list. Creative list, out of the box list.
Not weird.
Goodbye.
Not weird. Okay, I'm sorry. And of course, you can catch it tonight, Friday night, for Beat the Press. Coming up, is the MBTA's Commuter Appreciation Day too little, too late? Does one free day on the rails and roads make up for months of literal and figurative train wrecks? We're asking you next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. You know the old joke, first prize a week in Cleveland, second prize 2 weeks in Cleveland. I can't believe I'm laughing at my own thing there. Well, does that logic apply to today's MBTA Commuter Appreciation Day, with the second prize here being a free ride on a busted transportation system? Our question, you were only going to spend a few minutes on this. We just wanted to sample it. Does today's free fare Friday make up for the MBTA's winter fiasco? Our number is 877-301-8970. The free fares apply to all modes of transportation. T has also called for a 15% or announced a 15% discount on monthly MBTA passes for May. Total cost of the agency, they say, is roughly about $5 million. Is this the first step in regaining public trust? 877-301-8970. You know what the most pathetic part of this is? And this is only anecdotal, and feel free to call and say I'm wrong. Not one person who I've spoken to today who took the T said there was any signage, any indication other than an open gate at the subway station, which often it is by mistake, no indication, no signs, no congratulations, no thank you for your winter patience. The ride is on us. Wouldn't you think they'd want the public to know that they were trying to do something in a public-spirited way? Nobody knew.
I mean, let's face it. The whole thing is just doomed. You know what I'm saying? I mean, to think that one day with a free fare could make up for that endless fiasco. Well, it doesn't even, you know, I think the free coffee was nice. I think they had free donuts at some places,
Dunkin' Donuts, I think, provided them at some locations, I'm told. But can I tell you, I'm like with Shirley Leung on this. When you asked her that question at the beginning, her answer was, only in Boston could people be angry about a free anything. They're getting a free day. Charlie Baker and the head of the tea are not saying, by the way, now you're happy? Does this make up for everything? We don't have to fix the T. It's one tiny step to show we know we screwed up big time. We're trying to show you on day one while we're doing the big time fix that we get it. I'm not saying it's anything bigger than that. But at the worst part of this is they didn't even know how to publish.
When school is in Boston.
Well, that actually, that is worse.
You know, here are all these kids taking the T. They could have had a free day. It would have been great. The poor kids.
Well, they all have passes anyway, don't they, kids?
I guess they do. Most of them do. But I don't know. It would have been nice if they had the day the kids were there. But I guess it's nice. I got to say, I'm not really all that wowed by it. All I can think about is every time I see the trains go by me, and I almost never take the T anymore. But every time I see them go by, I think, They look so decrepit. I mean, they look like your car after 10 years on the road, full of like ice and snow, and everything starts to rust. You know that look of your car, and after a while, you're so embarrassed you can't drive it anywhere.
Yeah, your
car.
You think
if you go to a valet parker, he's going to say, "Lady, keep your tip. You need it more than I do." That kind of thing. That's what the T trains look like.
Well, you know what's going to happen when the Olympics comes.
What's going to happen?
Exactly. 877-301-8970. We only have a few minutes for this. We just wanted to check in with you guys. Let's start with John and Melrose. What do you think, John?
Thanks, guys. I believe it's a train wreck. They're not picked up for anything. This is a scandal for generations. They need, you know what? You know, with the internet nowadays, people realize what's going on with places like the Olympics, etc. And they didn't even tell the people. I heard your news earlier. They didn't even tell the people that it was free.
We don't know one person who knew, other than from having heard it in the radio or something, that it was free. How can you not publicize? This sort of speaks
to
the problem.
Maybe they thought there'd be too many people.
I don't think so.
I'm calling on every hobo in this greater Boston to ride the rails tonight. Please, get out.
Hobo. I haven't heard that word in about 20 years. Yeah. John, thanks for a great
call.
Thank
you for the call. Sean from Denham.
Oh, I bet you were on the T
today, weren't you, Sean?
Oh, guys, unbelievable. You know what? First of all, more Emily, less Jim.
We'll see what we can do, Sean.
I'll talk to her about it.
Hey, Jim, maybe once a month we can have a list that you could come on, and then we'll
I heard you. Okay, fine. Go ahead.
Love you, buddy. Hey, listen, the MBTA is ridiculous in so many levels. So they take a week where it's school vacation. Most parents take the week off with their kids. It's probably the ridership's probably down this week anyways. And they pick today. Are you kidding me?
I know.
You know what they could have done? How about paying people's mask type tolls or something like that? Extend beyond the T. I mean, just how about advertising it? I mean, how about advertising? My sister-in-law called today and said, "Oh, the T was free today." I'm like, "I knew that." She was like, "I didn't," and she rides it every day.
So, that was what everybody said. The people that ride it every day get on. They had no idea it was free.
So, Sean, I can sum it up. You feel pretty good about it.
You know what? I think the T should run the Olympics. Have a great day.
Goodbye, Sean. You know, it is.
You see what I mean, Jim?
No, I don't see what you mean.
I have tapped into this level of cynicism.
No, but yeah.
You haven't tapped in yet.
No, but John and Sean and you, the implication is that the people leading the T are saying, this is how we make it up to you. They're not saying that. It's one little token to show that we understand that we really did you
and
wrong
I'm saying
this winter.
There's a lack of confidence around here. When you're asking why Charlie Baker's numbers are as high as they are, because I think some people think, wow, let's not get too excited, but maybe we actually have someone who's competent.
So what's
for
it got
change
to do with this? He supports this free thing.
Because it's got to do with the sense of people just thinking everything is like the Keystone Cops around here. You know what I mean? I mean, you have people. I mean, people like Marty Walsh too in the city of Boston.
What did he say?
He didn't say anything.
So why'd you bring his name up?
Because I'm talking about not everybody's looked at as an incompetent.
I mean, people respect him too.
Yes, okay, I think they do. So we're in a little oasis here, Jim.
Patrick in the car. You're next on Boston Public Radio. I'm sure you loved it too. Hi, Patrick.
Oh yes, I've been listening.
Hi.
So, hey, how's it going, guys?
Good.
So I was thinking about the power of the surprise freebie. Mm. If you walk into a grocery store, they say, congratulations, you're the 1 millionth customer.
Oh,
even
yeah.
If it's $40 off or a free grocery trip, the excitement of that story will propel you a whole year.
You're a genius.
I was thinking this could be something that the T could use year after year, maybe once a quarter, once a half year, once a year. Just have one day that they don't advertise, and then all of a sudden, when the trains start rolling, people start throwing out their Twitter feed saying, congratulations, this is going to be the day, I think. It looks like it's free.
You're a genius. By the way, that is about 1,000 times better. Now, while some people would complain, well, they didn't tell us because they didn't want us to ride today. You're right. Social media would get it out in about 6.5 seconds. People would be wildly excited because it was a surprise. Patrick, that's a brilliant idea. We're going to pass it on to somebody. I'm not sure who, but we're going to do it. Thanks so much for your call, Patrick. We appreciate it.
Bob in Harvard Square. You're over there, Harvard Square. Did you ride the T for free today, Bob?
Hey, Bob.
Yes, actually, I did. I usually call you from Arlington.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I'm retired, and I said, you know, the heck with it. Let me take advantage of the free ride.
Great.
So there's a bus on my right in front of my house on Pleasant Street. I hopped on. I'm into Harvard Square, sitting on a bench, reading my book. And I figured, what the heck? Why not?
That's true. You can kind of go wild on days like this, Bob, right? Kind of just let it all hang out.
Yeah. As far as free signage you were talking about,
Yeah,
when
no
I got
signage.
On the bus on Pleasant Street, the only signage I saw is the driver had a white piece of paper scribbled over the box with Sharpie that said free.
No, are you making that up or is that true?
No, it's absolutely
that
true.
That is pathetic.
Absolutely true. You know, 8x11 piece of paper, you know, all torn at the top where it comes out of the spiral. It was taped on the box and in black magic marker it said free.
You didn't take a picture of that, did you?
Oh, you know what? No, I wish I did.
Well, it's a great story.
You know
Bob,
what?
Thanks for sharing that. That says
That's
it
perfect.
All. That really is.
Sums it all up.
Oh, my God.
Okay.
Thank you all.
Coming up, the Batmobile has got nothing on the Barmobile. The people behind a cocktail lounge on wheels. Join us next for our Friday news quiz. Stay tuned to that in 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 are two members of an entrepreneurial trio. Domingo Martin Barreras. I did pretty good, didn't I, Domingo
hey,
Martin? Thank you very much. Jim. And Susie Desjeunet. How about that?
Very well.
Thank
good
you
job.
Very much. I'm Jim Browdy. Are here in Studio 3. They, along with their partner Kevin Mabry, are converting a 1946 airliner into a cocktail lounge on wheels, which they are calling the Barmobile. Domingo Martin is the creative director. Susie is the logistics officer. It's great to meet you both.
Okay. Now, before we get anywhere close to the news quiz, I got to find out what this Barmobile deal is. I mean, I saw the picture, but this is, you know, not what it's going to end up looking like. So what's this Barmobile going to look like when you get this thing done?
Well, it's going to look – it's going to be restored to its glory from back in the 40s, but it will be retrofitted with – two bars on the passenger side, a back bar on the driver's side, so we can service large weddings, large events. The back will actually have a very beautiful lounge area for, say, the wedding party to hang out in and imbibe in.
How many people can fit on this thing?
Well, probably just 6 to 8 in the back, but the side windows actually flip up, and the windows are eye level, so we will literally be servicing the guests through the window. It'll be a service bar. There'll be two side by side, Kevin and myself.
You know, I know that, Susie, that you talk a lot about innovation. When I read about this for the first time, I said to myself, this idea is so obvious and so great. Is anybody else doing this anywhere?
Thank you. There are a few people that are doing something similar with the 12C catering license that is relatively new. It's from 2000.
And what is that? I read about that. What does that mean?
So it's a catering license that allows caterers on private property to bring both food and alcohol. The people who are using it right now are most likely just bringing cases of wine and things like that, and they're serving in the very traditional black and white uniform, Chardonnay and, vodka soda, sort of thing. So we're taking that and we're kind of flipping it. So we are also doing food and beverage, but emphasis on beverage and less on the food. So cocktail party style food instead of a full catered event with beverage.
And the city has been my understanding, ordinarily when you hear something like this, the first thing you say, I'm sure, is entrepreneurs, you say, oh my God, this is going to be decades before we get... They're into this.
We met with the ABCC.
Alcohol and Beverage Control Commission.
And they had an inspector there, and it was very formal and a little maybe intimidating. And they thought when we asked that we were going to roll up to Faneuil Hall with a food truck and try to sell beers. And then when we told them that we had done our homework with the 12C, they're like, that's brilliant. No one has used it in this application, and I don't know why they haven't, but we support this 100%.
I think it's kind of too bad you can't roll up to Faneuil Hall and start selling
Not yet.
Not yet. Because it would be the idea of having like a little rolling cocktail lounge.
I saw a place in New York that was actually cordoned off. I don't remember what square it was, but they had a bar sort of food truck outside. It was fixed. It didn't roll anywhere.
Yep.
But,
can I tell you something? That's not enough. When we first met Commissioner Evans, this has nothing to do – well, it does have something to do with you guys. First thing I asked him the first day he comes here every month, police commissioner – is in my hometown of Philadelphia, where I haven't been in ages, they have a whole main downtown street, which in summer months is closed. You can drink out on the street. You can stroll down this beautiful street in the city. like you can do in New Orleans, that sort of thing. And I know that makes them nervous, but this is like a step in that kind of direction. So ultimately, it's private parties and that sort of things that can call you up, hire you, and then you're a soup to nuts kind of deal, right?
Correct, correct. Yeah, so if you're the kind of person who likes to host events and have different things at your house and you're looking for just something new and different
And it's beautiful.
I mean, and the buses are going to gorgeous. Be amazing.
And you're getting your money through a Kickstarter campaign? Is that what you're doing here?
Yes, we
How's
are.
How's that going?
Please.
How's that going?
It is going. We are 23% funded, 9 days in. We have,
wow, that's great.
Yeah, which is excellent.
Yeah.
The money that we are hoping to raise is going straight to the retrofitting of the inside bar. We've already purchased the 1947. We've
Where'd
actually,
you find this thing?
Domingo found the 47 in California.
Yes. Yep.
It How'd was you out, get it out here?
I had someone put it on a trailer and drove it here.
Yep. Then, we actually have two.
Oh, you do?
Yes, we have a 1953 as well, which is currently in Arizona. And we are bringing that out here just as soon as we can. And it's getting a brand new engine, and that one will be able to drive right away.
How big are these?
The 47 is 30 feet, and the 53 is 35.
Wow.
So okay, so is there a Facebook page or a website for this when we start the quiz? How do people find out about you guys?
Facebook is The Barmobile. And Twitter is also at The Barmobile.
Fair enough. Let's start the quiz. Who do you want to start with, Marjorie?
I'll start with Domingo. You ready, Domingo? Yes. Okay, listen to this clip from Seth Meyers.
You guys, today is and this year, I'm finally going to do it. I'm going to find out what the blue trash cans are for. Because I'm starting to think it's not just blue trash.
Okay. Do you know what holiday was this week? Has something to do with blue trash cans?
It's not really a holiday. What? Something. Observance? Something. Yeah.
What, Patriots Day?
No. It was. That was. But that was not what it was.
It was Earth Day.
Earth Day.
Oh, listen to her. She takes
you
it.
You are correct. Nice. Very good. Okay. You started an early lead, Susie.
That's why she's the logistics officer of this operation, quite obviously. Well, you can take a whopping 2-point lead if you get this right, Susie.
Okay.
3 years ago, it was revealed that General David Petraeus had an affair. Listen to this Stephen Colbert clip from way back in 2012.
Petraeus had an affair with the author of his fawning biography, All In. This explosive revelation puts every biographer and subject under suspicion, meaning we can now say with some certainty that Doris Kearns Goodwin banged Abraham Lincoln.
Why is David, where do I miss him? Why is David Petraeus in the news this week, Susie? Do you know?
Oh, my goodness. I do not know. So well, there goes my lead.
Domingo, you can tie this baby up right here. How about it? David Petraeus, why is he in the news?
I don't know. He wrote a book.
That's close.
He was sentenced to 2 years of probation and a $100,000 fine for sharing classified information with his, quote, biographer. So it's 1-0 at the end of one round.
Okay, here we go.
How'd you get this idea? Whose idea was this, by the way?
Domingo.
Where'd this come from?
You're
like a party boy kind of guy?
No, a lot of it came from working in nice restaurants and having guests say, you know, can you come to my house and do what you do there? But once you get there, there's like an island and I have my tools. But, you know, how do we bring all
this thing
there? But the licensing wasn't there. And then it was. And then I was on a smaller scale. And then Kevin and I started talking and we went. Big. And when we went to the ABCC, it was like, this can't be possible. And it was. So,
you know, if you were going to have one of these, your Barmobile come and you say you lived in a triple decker or something like that, you'd have to get what, like some kind of a party permit or something on the street to have you guys there. How would that work?
You want to take this?
So essentially, if say you want to rent a pod, one of those.
Storage things
that you put out in front of your house, you have to call and say, hey, can I put this here? Most likely, we will have to do that. They'll have you know, postage on some trees and say on this date from this time.
Because you are right. I mean, lots of people would want to have a party in their apartment, maybe for 20 or 30 people, and they can't do it because they don't have any room to have something like that. So how cool would that be to have a little outdoor kind of deal going on, especially in the nice hot weather?
And by the way, Joe Caratoni, I think I've heard, Somerville, who's got a pretty creative management thing, he's been talking to you guys too, is he not, about doing things?
Yes. He was one of the first people who emailed, actually.
That's great.
Well, he's a big party animal, I understand, Joe Curtis.
Let's go to round two, Marjorie.
Okay, here is Seth Meyers talking about a group that's come under fire a lot recently.
Hey, I think I know what your secret is. You suck at your jobs. You're supposed to be taking a bullet for the president, not an Ambien. It's the president's home. It should be harder to get into than Arizona State.
Okay. Who's he talking about there, and why are they in trouble again this week?
I think Secret Service, but I think it's also there was a couple things. There was the gyrocopter. And the guy jumping the fence with
jump the
bag.
Fence. Whoa. That is right. That
just
is
trying
it.
To redeem myself.
Give me an extra half a point for that. That was excellent.
Okay.
Now, I don't think he was supposed to answer that question, but who cares? Now, in
did
any
I ask
case,
the wrong question?
I don't know. Susie, here's your question.
Okay.
You ready?
Oops.
Now it's tied. Are you aware of that? Actually, he has an extra half a point because I gave it to him.
Okay.
A prominent person participated in Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates' DNA project to trace his ancestral roots. Turns out, this person had a slave-owning ancestor, and he requested the program not broadcast that fact. Here's the great Larry Wilmore joking about it.
You know, if you're in the public eye, who really has the courage to acknowledge this type of ugly ancestral episode? I mean, it makes sense.
Other stars like Ken Burns and Anderson Cooper both have slave-owning ancestors that were featured on the show.
It's shameful, and I feel just a sense of shame over it.
That's called owning it. I don't mean owning them. I mean owning it. It's my bad.
Okay, so who requested that Henry Louis Gates not talk about his slave owning ancestor.
I do know this one. It is Ben Affleck.
That is exactly
our favorite
correct.
Movie star. And if he wants to have a party, just go, you know.
That's right.
Call us up.
Or his family or somebody.
Yeah. You can have like all the kids out there serving cocktails. Yeah, okay. Here we go, Domingo. Who is John Oliver talking about in this clip? And why is he in the news this week?
Perhaps his fatal flaw is that he's done 870 daily hour-long shows about health and medicine. Which is impossible. You're going to get tempted to overstretch and do a show with a title like Can an Aspirin a Day Keep Cancer Away? To which the answer is clearly no. Not entirely, because I feel like if it did, we wouldn't be hearing about it for the first time at 4 p.m. on a Wednesday afternoon.
Okay. Do you know who he's talking about?
I don't. Dr. Oz?
Yes!
You are correct!
You go!
Yeah, he was in the news this week because a group of physicians asked the dean of Columbia University to revoke his faculty position.
How great does it feel, Domingo Martin, when you have no idea what the answer to something is, and you guess, and you're humiliated, and you're right? Does it get any better now?
That didn't suck.
You know, so beautifully put. Susie, you know, beyond the logistics of this thing, which I know is your bailiwick or whatever, I assume the quality of the drink produced is pretty extraordinary. Does any of the three of you have expertise in this area? What's the deal?
Yes, both Domingo and Kevin are going to be the talent. They're going to be shaking up the drinks. I'm really the person that's in the back. But what's really exciting, specifically for Barmobile, is both Kevin and Domingo have years and years of experience with fine spirits, classic cocktails. Their wealth of knowledge are their cocktail encyclopedias, essentially. And it's really cool to do something different.
So where were you a bartender? Any place around here?
Yes.
Can you say?
No, I was going to say to all of them, pretty much. I work at Bogey's Place now, which is in the back room at J.M. Curley's.
Yes.
I opened the W at Market by Jean Georges.
Oh, wow.
Foundation room. All the way back to the Channel days is kind of where I cut my
teeth.
Oh, my
goodness.
Okay, so you're at Assembly Square at the request of Joe Curtatone, and the first person comes up to you, Domingo, and says, what's your specialty? What should I have? What fits Assembly Square in Somerville? What do you say? What's your best drink?
I would probably go to an old fashioned.
That's a great old. That's like a madman drink.
Yeah. Well, it's an old city with a lot of history. And
yeah, like that's it, a good one.
Okay.
That's a good one.
Susie, I have no idea what the score is. The judges will tell us in a minute, but here's your
question.
I'm
just going to say I'm winning.
Okay, that's fine. No, that's good. It's the logistics, whatever you are. Here's a woman on YouTube talking about what she ate one day this week.
I made myself an Ezekiel English muffin, cinnamon raisin. This is my favorite. I toasted it. I had some peanut butter, and then I also had a banana. And then I also had a shot of this Vega sugar-free energizer. I actually had the Clif Bar mocha. I also had some jelly beans. I made a smoothie with some almond milk. I did another banana, and then I had 3 mini macaroons, and I was still hungry, so I had a Kind strong bar.
Exactly. So what happened this week that would make someone like that involved hungry? What might that be, please?
As a lady, I want to give the obvious answer to me when you need that much sugar, but that's probably not it.
Well, give it to us anyway. What is it?
I'm guessing she's PMSing.
Okay. Now, even though that is dead wrong, you got to give her a point for that. Now, that's Domingo, do you have any idea what the right answer is?
I'm going to say marathon.
That is exactly
that
right.
That is correct.
But frankly, even though that was the right answer, it wasn't nearly as good as hers, so I'll only give him a half a point. So I think that makes it tie if he gets a half. It is tie going into the bonus round. Now, here are the rules of the bonus round, you two. And we're talking to the people from the Barmobile. Our guests are the masterminds behind the Boston Barmobile. In honor of them, and as you know, it's the MBTA's free day, the theme of this week's news quiz is another notable transportation method, which, of course, is the Batmobile.
That's correct.
Now, you would ask the first question, Marjorie.
And I always point out these are multiple choice questions, which almost everybody gets wrong, so
no,
don't worry
don't.
About it.
Go ahead.
The original Batmobile, introduced in Detective Comics number 27 in May 1939, was much less glamorous than today's Batmobile. What kind of ride was it? A, a red sedan, B, a Ford Model T, or C, a minivan with a baby on board sticker?
I'm going to say B, Ford Model T.
Oh, that was a good guess.
You can steal the question, Domingo Martin.
I'm going to go with A.
You are correct.
Exactly correct.
A red sedan. Very good.
You have a pretty good voice. You ever done radio?
I used to do some voiceover stuff.
You did?
Yeah, back in the day.
Glad you don't do it anymore. Okay, here we go. One of the original Batmobiles used in... This is your question,
okay.
Domingo. One of the original Batmobiles used in the Michael Keaton films is street legal with a license plate that drops down when the car starts. Who owns it? There are three choices. A, former Congressman Aaron Schock. B, comedian Jeff Dunham, who's the great ventriloquist, whatever. He's unbelievable. C, Peter Wolfe, obviously local guy, lead vocalist for the J. Giles Band. Who is it, A, B, or C?
I'm going to go with B.
That is right again.
Wow, very good.
Now, let me explain what's going on here, Susie. You are 2 points down. Now, the good news for you, this is very rare, but the final question is worth 2 points. So you can either end up in tie with your coworker, or there's going to be a lot of bad vibes.
Okay.
So do your best, okay?
Okay, here we go.
Here it is.
Which of the following is a real gadget inside the Batmobile?
Real gadget.
A, the battering ram for breaking down doors. Mm-hmm. B, the battery, an instantly charged electric shock taser. C, the batterer, an emergency deep fryer.
Take
battering
your time.
Ram, battery,
huge.
Or batterer.
You're the logistics officer. Do you know that?
Yes.
You are. So, I mean, mm-hmm. in that capacity, this should be quite easy.
I would say A.
You are correct.
Wow. And it is a tie.
Battering ram.
Congratulations. So where does this thing go? I mean, assuming you raise your money on Kickstarter, you get this first thing going, you have a second bus, and wherever it is in Arizona, it's on its way. What's the vision of this thing, Domingo Martin? What's your where does this go? What?
Well, yeah. I mean, the license itself is all of Massachusetts. But
this 12C thing that you're talking
correct.
About?
Correct.
Okay.
So we see it going anywhere. You know, I made a joke the other day. You know, if you have the room, we have the room. So we can go.
Oh,
it can
that.
Go anywhere. And we want to make it sort of a classy addition to an event. I'm not saying that we're not going to do certain events, but we think it'll add a bit of class to a nice event, and we'd kind of like to keep it on that level, but. You know, for weddings, for birthdays, for if you have a house on the Cape, or Nantucket, for that matter.
Well, that's perfect. That's what I was going to. Marjorie and her sister have a house on the Cape.
Yes, we do.
Her parents left to him. So, okay. So, logistics officer,
done.
Susie.
Yes.
What are we talking about? I understand different levels of what kind of ballpark are we talking about if Marjorie and her sister decided, I want the Barmobile to come to the Cape house to do a little thing for us. What are we talking about?
Dollar-wise?
Yeah.
So we're going to have different levels of packages, starting with very simple. This is our well bar. These are the classic cocktails we can make mm-hmm. from this well bar. You can pick 2 to 3 custom cocktails, especially for your event, plus beer, plus wine, and all
neat.
Of that kind of thing. And then we'll bring bar snacks. That will be the very basic.
Okay, and let's assume she had 20 people at her house. What are we talking about, roughly, just to give us a range?
We'll probably be doing that package at $25 a head. So
That sounds pretty good to me.
That's not that bad. But we do have to keep in mind that it is a vehicle that runs on gasoline.
Yeah, the further away, the more it's going to cost.
And we'll have packages that go starting at around you know, $500, $600, $700 for the beverage.
When are we going to see this thing? Assuming everything goes well with Kickstarter.
Assuming everything goes well for the Kickstarter, we are really hoping to get at least 12 events in 2015.
Wonderful.
That would make us very, very happy.
But mostly a summer and fall kind of thing, right?
However, corporate events and things of that nature do tend to rent warehouses and things all winter long. We are definitely willing to get her out of her garage.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. This is going to be a big garage. Where do you park this thing?
We don't know yet.
Oh, okay.
That's on our agenda.
We also have 8 seats inside. So if you just want to have, you know, 4 couples or 7 of your other friends sit in there, we'll
bring it.
Now, before you guys go, I've known Marjorie for 16 or 17 years, and I think what she'd probably want is, do you do a martini-only barmobile? Would that be possible?
We will customize anything anyone wants.
Yes. So make sure you leave her your number. Will you do that?
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay.
Good luck with your project.
Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being here.
Domingo, Martine Barreras, and Susie
Dejeuner.
Thank you. Along with her partner, Kevin Mabry, are converting a 1946 airliner into a cocktail lounge on wheels, the Barmobile. Susie is the logistics officer. Domingo's the creative director. Thank you both for coming in. And thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Please tune in on Monday for Bob Thompson's Best and Worst TV Moments of the Week, plus our political roundtable. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio. Chelsea Murs, Will Rosa, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen. Our engineer today is Alan Mattis. Thank you guys very much for all your work this week. I am Marjorie Egan.
You know, we should also say at 8 o'clock on Channel 2, you know what's on tonight?
Oh, Sing That Thing.
Episode 2, Sing That Thing.
It is really fun. If you haven't seen it, tune in at 8 o'clock. You'll absolutely love it. Jared Bowen comes right after that at 8:30.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Yeah, I'm Marjorie Egan. Thanks for listening. Please
have a great
tune
weekend.
In again on Monday.